Welcome to episode 68 of GBW Podcast. My name's Chris. With me is Josh.
Hi.
How you doing, man?
I'm good.
Today, we're going to talk about some monsters, Egyptian style.
Yes.
We're going to talk about some mummies, or as Josh likes to refer to them, yummy mummies.
Some of them.
He wanted to call the episode Yummy Mummies.
We're also going to talk about like tombs a little bit, too.
A little bit, yeah. So before we dive into the world of, gauze.
Yeah, we don't want to get wrapped up in that too quickly.
Let's talk about what we've been watching.
Okay.
And why don't you kick her off, because you have a few more titles than me this time.
Okay. So I had a theatrical experience. I went to see Wonder Woman.
All right.
So, the most anticipated superhero movie of the year, I would say.
I think so.
Like, we kind of almost forget that Justice League is coming out later this year. I don't know why.
I can't believe how, like, super hyped everyone is for this movie.
Yeah.
Like, super hyped.
They're really hyped.
This is one of the few times I've seen, like, women who I never expected to be into this kind of movie just gushing on Facebook about how excited they are.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, I don't really understand. Like, I kind of understand because Wonder Woman's a pretty iconic character. And, you know, she did steal the show in Batman versus Superman, in my opinion.
Not hard to do, apparently.
No, definitely not. So I was pretty pumped going into this, too. I was really looking forward to it. Now, okay, first of all, like, it does suffer from what I've complained about on the show before with the superhero movies, these big budget movies. I, again, don't really understand why they're giving it to a director who's Patty Jenkins. Really, her only credit before this is Monster.
Which is a really good movie, but it's completely not what you would think would get you a job directing a superhero movie.
Right. So again, like, kind of don't really get the logic there. So, yeah, like I said, going into this, I was pretty excited. Pretty quickly, I was not as excited. Now, I can't really rip on this movie because it wasn't a bad movie. I wasn't, like, angry, and I wasn't, like, I hate the characters. It was just another superhero movie. Like, nothing really stood out for me.
Is it an origin one again?
It's an origin one. Well, it's sort of an origin one. Like, it opens up with, it opens up trying to tie it into the DC universe. Then it flashes back to her as a child on, like, Amazon Island. And that part,
it kind of goes all Superman, 78 Superman a little bit.
Kind of.
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit. But it goes to Amazon Island, and it shows, like, all the Amazons on the island. I was surprised to see Robin Wright there. She was playing kind of the leader of the, or the sort of best warrior there that trains all the other warriors. And it also had Connie Nielsen from Gladiator. She's been in other stuff too.
Yeah.
She plays Wonder Woman's mom, and Wonder Woman at this point is Wonder Child. And I kind of like this part, seeing all the Amazon women fighting and stuff. But pretty soon after that, Chris Pine shows up playing I'm totally not prepared for this review, but playing the guy, the army general that befriends Wonder Woman. If you've seen the TV show, you know who I'm talking about, the Lyle Waggoner character.
Right.
This is where I was starting to be, and this is about 20 minutes in. It's the first big fight sequence, probably the best fight sequence I thought of the movie, but it's Amazons fighting German World War I soldiers on the beach, which I thought was kind of cool. But right away, I'm like, oh, yeah, I always forget about the CGI fest that is superhero movies. And it always kind of takes away from it for me, because the minute you start to see the characters leaping around, being, really kind of unrealistic in their movements and stuff, I'm taken out of the movie a bit. And that's what I find is a problem with a lot of these movies, and it's a big problem I had with this movie.
His character is Steve Trevor, by the way.
Steve Trevor, yeah. Chris Pine was fine. I didn't like the fact that they switched it to World War One from World War Two, which I'm used to from the TV series. If you're familiar with the show, the first season was set in World War II, and then the second two seasons were contemporary. So I was kind of expecting World War II. World War I just seemed a little... I didn't really quite understand why they made that change. Because it takes, you know, away... some of the, like, you know, airplane, like some of the, just the technology that would, right. I would have thought it would have made it a little more exciting. And then, yeah, I just found the movie just kind of dragged on a bit. Yeah, there were some action scenes and yeah, there was a few cool sequences. But overall, I was kind of let down a little bit. I wasn't super jazzed on it. One thing that really, really, really bothered me about this, and it bothered me in the trailer, but I didn't think it would be throughout the whole movie, was the score. So the composer is Rupert Gregson Williams, and it's got a real, like, kind of primal thumping drum beat,
right?
And then a, like, screaming guitar over it, playing kind of almost like a almost like classical piece, and it just really annoyed me, and it annoyed me a lot in the trailer, and then it kept coming up through the movie, and I felt it really didn't fit, and it pissed me off every time it happened. And I just don't really understand why people are so in love with this movie. It was good, but it wasn't blowing my socks off.
I think the reason people are in love with this movie is because it's a female lead more than anything.
Maybe.
Like, but... I honestly think that, like, I think that's expanded the audience for this, because you have these, you know, quasi-feminist girls who are like, oh, finally a superhero for me,
kind of way, right? I guess I can kind of see that.
Like... I mean, great. It's great that they've made a superhero movie where it's a female lead and, you know, and she's a strong woman in the movie and everything, but, you know, I'm so tired of superheroes in general. And it's like you said, it's like, I don't see these movies because I watch the trailer and it's a CG-a-thon.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah. Like, I do look forward to all of them, and I do always go in hoping for a good movie. And once in a while, a good one does come along. Like, I thought the first Captain America was really good.
Yeah, I enjoyed that
one. I thought Ant-Man was pretty good. I love Guardians of the Galaxy. So, I mean, there are ones that come along that are good. So every time I go into it thinking, this could be awesome. Right. But then I just find quite often I'm like, oh, yeah, that was all right. It was a superhero movie.
I've always felt like nowadays it's like this is a DC Comics movie. But
yeah,
I feel like all the Marvel ones now are set in such a locked down formula that people go to see them no matter what, just so they can see that scene after the credits that ties it to the next Marvel movie that's coming out and stuff like that. So how does Wonder Woman, does it do that to tie into Justice League at all?
No, there's no post-credit stuff in this.
So it's like, this is like, you could totally watch this standalone and Justice League wouldn't be like...
Like, it ties into Justice League a little bit. I mean, like, at the beginning of the movie opens with her, I guess she works at the Louvre in Paris, and a Wayne Enterprises, like, van drives by, and you know, she gets, a note from Bruce Wayne.
So just really, like, subtle tie-ins in a way.
Yeah, I mean, as much as you can tie it in from
after... subtle as you can be in a superhero movie.
From after Batman versus Superman, right? Because it does have to lead. And then she also is going to be in Justice League. So it does sort of come off of Batman versus Superman, and then it goes off into Justice League. Like, you can tell she's still awesome, like, at the end, right? But I guess my biggest thing with this, too, is the fight scenes really bothered me. Like, after this first... sort of siege on the beach with the Amazons, it then goes into, like, they go to London and you know, she's buddied up to Steve, and then they go into the battlefield because she's trying to defeat this enemy, because she thinks if she defeats this god, then people will stop fighting the war, right? So that's kind of her mission. And I found as soon as they left, like, Amazon Island, I kind of lost it a bit. And then the thing is, in the fight sequences, other than the Amazon Island one, it does a lot of, like, you know, like, she'll, like, jump in the air to, like, kick someone, and then it will go into slow motion, and the camera pans around.
Yeah, I dislike that in, like, most action movies. That's a carryover still from The Matrix, for crying out loud.
Yeah, or she'll, like, slide on the floor, and then it will, like, it'll pause and then the camera will like pan around and then the action will continue. And
I find that doesn't add any excitement to a movie for me though.
Well, it makes me feel like they don't know how to choreograph fights.
Yeah.
Like, it makes me feel like they're like, okay, well, we don't really know how to choreograph this, so it's really good. We're going to just slow it down and do all these cool camera tricks and make it look like we know what we're doing with the fights.
I think it's just become a style of modern movies with action sequences in it.
Like, yeah, but again, like, I go back to, like, the Daredevil TV show, and, like, the fighting on there is pretty kick-ass.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they can't bring some of that type of realism into these films. Now, maybe it's because the younger generation is so used to that style now, they think regular old martial arts is lame. I don't know what the deal is, but I don't like that stylized action sequence stuff, and this happened a lot. And again, I was thinking, well, that's what happens when you put a drama director doing a fucking action movie.
Yeah, like Monster is... It came out in 2004.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
And this is like the first actual movie she's done since then.
Yeah.
And it's just, I like, when I saw that, I was like, okay, this is weird. Because Monster is a you know, based on Eileen Wuornos, who is like one of the most notorious female serial killers in history. It's a good movie.
Yeah.
Very good movie, very good performances, but it's so unlike a superhero movie.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did DC Comics just feel that because Wonder Woman is a woman superhero movie, it was necessary for them to sign on a female director? Like,
yeah.
Like, that's what I'm like, why would you hire this person? What have they done that would make you go, oh, she would be awesome for Wonder Woman?
Well, I know. Like, why not give that girl who did Punisher Warzone a job?
Yeah, Lexi like, Alexander.
You know, she'd be awesome. Like,
I mean, those Punisher Warzone action sequences are pretty damn
outrageous.
Think, outrageous.
Why not do that? Like, that's what I don't get. Like, why are you giving it to the director of Monster instead of Lexi Alexander?
So how is the main actress, though? She's played Wonder Woman twice now. So
Gal Gadot, I mean...
how is she in this? Because all I hear is praise for her, so...
She's fine. Like,
she's no Linda Carter? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's pretty hard. Like, I was trying really hard not to compare her
to... Well, you grew up with Wonder Woman, so
that
would be why you were doing it, too, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's more a warrior. Now, I know that actress, like, her background is not, like, supermodel. Her background is she was a fucking, like, soldier in the Israeli army or something.
Right.
It's not like she's a wimp. I just thought I wasn't buying a lot of her emotion, I guess. Like,
right.
Like... Yeah, like, I don't want to give too much away about the plot, but just some of the turns in the plot, I was like, really? Like, I just wasn't really buying it too much. And
okay.
And another actor in this that I also thought was a little misused was, or miscast, is David Thewlis. He was Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah, he's in this Mike Lee movie called Naked in 1993.
Yeah, and I know him most from that movie Naked because he freaked me the shit out.
Yeah, he's
movie.
Really good in that movie.
And it's a really depressing movie, mm-hmm. and he does a like monologue in that movie that just bummed me out, and I still think about it. So I think of him as a dramatic actor, even though he's been in some other stuff. That's what I think of.
Yeah, I'm same so, on that with him.
He's one of the main characters in this. And again, I just thought a little miscast. But Gal Gadot, I think she's fine. Like, it could be worse, that's for sure. I think she was fine. I don't really have any qualms about it. That's the whole thing with this movie. Like, I'm not saying, oh, it was shit. I'm not saying don't go see it. I'm just saying it wasn't as epic as I was expecting based on the reviews and the box office. And I'm glad it's doing well. I mean, that's good for them. It's good for DC, I think, just because I do kind of want them to succeed because there's a lot of cool characters in the DC universe. I just feel like they've been kind of shitting on Superman and Batman, so I kind of want them to pick it up a bit, which I think they've done a little bit here.
The thing is, too, is like I've always kind of liked DC's characters better than Marvel's characters, to be honest with you.
Right, yeah.
Like, the
yeah.
Marvel character I've always liked is Punisher.
Right.
You know, and they're never going to do a big screen Punisher movie because he's too violent. You know, that's a Netflix show.
It is going to be a Netflix show.
But, you know, DC's got Superman, they've got Batman, you know, there are always characters that I personally liked more. Like, I like Batman and Superman more than I like, let's say, Spider-Man and Iron Man and stuff like that. So it is good to see Marvel actually getting some healthy competition, because Marvel movies just fucking roll over everybody. Yeah. So it's good to see Wonder Woman get out there and take them on. And like, the thing is, I haven't seen Wonder Woman, but I'm happy it's doing well and that it's getting good reviews, because the two DC movies that came out before this, even though they made money, are supposed to be garbage. You know, Suicide Squad and Batman versus Superman are supposed to be garbage. So it's good to see that DC's actually made a movie that's supposed to be pretty decent.
Yeah, it's pretty decent. Like, you know, I guess my thing is I've been hearing stuff like it's the greatest superhero movie ever made.
Right.
Like, those are some of the reviews.
That's kind of hard to do when you've got Raimi's Spider-Man 2 out there, though, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think that's a little much. So let's just put it that way. Okay. That's a little much.
All right.
It was fine. She's fine. it was good. It was good, but it wasn't great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good enough. So for my first entry, all I got to say to you, Josh, is fuck you. Don't tell people to bet on me, because I watched Police Academy 4 Citizens on Patrol.
Oh, you did? Oh, my God.
1987. So by this point in the series, I feel like the Police Academy movies were like the, you know, like how you have a favorite sweater. So it's like a sweater that you've been wearing for years and it's worn in, and it's, you know, there's nothing really special about it, but it's kind of comfortable and you're used to it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what the Police Academies are by part four.
Right.
Because you have to remember, this is four movies in 4 years. You know? Yeah. You got 84, 85, 86, and this one in 87. Now, I actually liked part four more than I liked two and three.
Oh.
So that's a good thing.
What's the subtitle on this one?
Citizens on Patrol.
Okay.
So what this is it's the same kind of...
What was the subtitle in the last movie?
Back in Training.
Oh, okay.
And then the part two was their first assignment.
Right. Okay.
And part five, which I'll be watching soon, is called Assignment Miami Beach. So anyway, Citizens on Patrol, it's your basic plot. You know, the mayor's decided that anybody can want to join on the police force and become citizens on patrol. So typical, your group of guys, you know, like Mahoney, Hightower, all those guys are, again, training them and making them into a police squad out of all these, like, regular guys. And, you know, it's got your typical, they've added new characters in, you know, they've added these skateboarder guys, they've added this overweight black guy to get the laughs out of him sitting on one end of a bench and a really skinny guy flying up in the air from the other end and landing through a basketball hoop. You know, jokes like that, right? It's just, but it's like, I know these aren't good movies.
Right.
But it's like I put them on and I'm like, okay, this is 90 minutes. I'm okay with this. I don't mind this.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think they're great. I get some chuckles, but I'm so familiar with the characters and some of the characters I really like. So I'm like, yeah, cool. You know, whatever. It's another Police Academy movie. You know, fun. Minimal fun, but fun.
Yeah.
You know, this is the last outing for Gutenberg, which kind of scares me.
Yeah.
When I go on to do part five, because he's such a... He kind of is the glue of this group of guys, because he's always the one I've always gravitated more
totally.
The most out of all these movies. So he's gone after this one. So I'm
like AC/DC without Bon Scott, right?
Yeah, well, Brian Johnson wasn't bad.
He's no Bon
Scott. But you know what I mean? But you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like, I'm kind of like, well, he's kind of the glue holding these guys together. Who are they going to put the main focus on in the next one? I'm like, it better not be fucking Jones. Because I've come to the conclusion after four movies and watching them so close together that I do not like Jones. So Jones is Michael Winslow.
Okay.
Who makes all the sound effects.
Yeah.
I do not like that character.
Really?
He gets on my nerves.
But he was sort of the one you remember. Like him.
But he gets on my nerves, dude. I just can't take him by now. I've realized now after four movies that I've watched in like the last 2 months that I just can't relate to this guy. Like, I like Hightower, I like Tackleberry, guys like that. And there is some good jokes in this. Like, there's a joke in it where there's these two skateboarder guys played by David Spade, of all people.
Oh, God.
And Brian Backer, who was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Ratner.
Backer.
No, was it Ratner from Fast Times?
Yeah. Mark Ratner? The Burning. He was in The Burning and Fast Times.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So he's in this as like David Spade's skateboarding buddy, and they get assigned by the judge to go to this Citizens on Patrol program. And there's a thing where they're like saying, "Ah, oh, you cops, you guys, you know, it's easy to do your job. You guys don't do nothing, right?" So Mahoney sets them up for this prank.
Yeah.
And there's this prank where like Hightower plays this like voodoo priest. So he's got like this big like dreadlocks and everything, and he's like doing this quote, "Ayama yama yama yama." And I think that's pretty funny, and I think that Bubba Smith actually sells that moment. I think it's a lot of fun. Because there's a punchline to that that I'm not going to ruin.
Okay.
But, you know, G.W. Bailey, who played Harris in the original movie, is back.
Okay, that's good.
Because he wasn't in 2 and 3. And he's back in it, and he's always been fun in these movies, even if the movies are lower quality. But this actor called Lance Kinsey, who's always kind of been the sidekick to the main guy, like he's Harris's G.W. Bailey's sidekick called Proctor, that guy steals the fucking movie.
Okay.
Every movie he almost steals because he's just so dense. His character is so dense, and he always has misunderstandings, and he always says stupid things, and that character just cracks me up.
Right.
And I don't know why, but he's always cracked me up. So, I mean, there's that. What I found on this one was that the focus was kind of spread very thin because they were trying to, like, focus on each individual member of the Police Academy people.
Right.
But they weren't getting quite enough screen time. But Bobcat Goldthwait's character Zed gets quite a bit of screen time because he gets a love interest in this movie. So his love interest is played by Corinne Boerer, who was in The Beach Girls, Zapped, They Call Me Bruce, I, the Jury. So she was in all these awesome movies in the 80s. And she plays his love interest, and it's actually a pretty likable subplot. I think they're cute together, and I think it works. So, I mean, it's like I said, Police Academy 4, not reinventing the wheel. It's like when you're cold at home and you put on a nice pair of old slippers you've had since you were a kid, it's just something it's a comfort.
Right.
And by this point for me, the Police Academy movies are just a comfort where I can put it on, spend 85 to 90 minutes with it, and turn my brain off.
Right.
So, you know, there it is. Police Academy 4.
Okay, so you're still having fun with them.
Huh?
You're still having fun
with them. I'm still enjoying them. They haven't hit the low point that I think Mission to Moscow is going to be. But thankfully, Mission to Moscow is the last one.
Right.
So what do you got now?
All right. Okay, I watched a really good flick.
I've got a couple of those, too.
Okay. This one's from 2012. It's called Here Comes the Devil.
Mm-hmm. I keep thinking about watching this one.
Yeah, it's really good. So it's directed by Adrian Garcia Bogliano, who also directed a werewolf movie called Late Phases. So I kind of knew the premise of this is that a couple are out in the desert with their kids, and their kids go missing, and then their kids show up again. But something's wrong. That's pretty much
all they've changed.
That's pretty much all I'm going to give you. But just a few things. Like, I mean, okay, this opens up with like a super intense lesbian sex scene, which I was totally not expecting. And it's like this probably the most intense sex scene opening of a movie I've ever seen, aside from Betty Blue. If you've seen Betty Blue, you know what I'm talking about. So that happens right away, and then it's quickly followed by a really brutal assault. So I was like, holy shit, like this movie's not wasting any time.
Titillation followed by violence.
It's brutal violence. So it was quite shocking in both ways. The thing got going quickly. And then we get into the desert with the couple. So it's a husband and wife and their two kids. They've got the husband and wife have a pretty dysfunctional relationship. The husband's pretty misogynistic. He's kind of a dick. Like, you're not really backing the guy too much, but he is one of the main characters, so you sort of have to. The wife's pretty cool. I liked her quite a bit. Played by her name was Sol, played by Laura Caro. The husband, by the way, is played by Francisco Barriero. He was one of the brothers in the original We Are What We Are, which I've reviewed on a past episode. You know, the kids go missing. You really start to see the husband and wife's relationship falling apart as it's happening. And then the kids come back And then it's just a series of things that happen. Just with the kids getting weirder and weirder. There's a scene with the babysitter, and it's just a pretty intense movie. Like I wasn't expecting the pacing of this movie to be what it was. I thought this was going to be a real slow burn, but I thought this moved super fast and there was a lot of stuff going on all the time, and I was totally engaged throughout. I also thought the filming of it was really well done. Like I thought some of the shots he chose were pretty cool. A lot of interesting zooms. They weren't like Jess Franco zooms. They were like a little quicker than that, but just a lot of it was really quite noticeable what was going on with the camera. And yeah, I just really really dug this movie. I'm surprised it actually hasn't been picked up for a remake yet. But yeah, I don't really want to talk about too much more just because I went into it knowing about as much as I've just said, and I think it's best that way. But I would definitely quite highly recommend this one for a Spanish thriller if you're looking for something different to check out.
Yeah, I always got the impression from just the artwork and stuff that it was like a Killer Kid movie. So
sort of, yeah. I mean, the kids are awesome. And usually, as you know, I'm not a big fan of kids in horror movies, but these two nailed it. So yeah, it's well, really well done.
Has that been taken down now, though?
Nope.
Okay, because I might check that out.
Maybe.
I've had it on my to-watch list for a while on Netflix, and I just haven't got around to it, because my problem is I put stuff on my to-watch list on Netflix, and then I get distracted by all the physical media I have sitting around that's been piling up that I keep buying. I'm like, oh, shit, I better watch some of that. I got to watch some of that. So
it might be gone, to be honest. But
okay. But it's worth probably picking up anyway.
I'd say it's worth picking up. Okay. It's a really good. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So since you said the word slow burn, I'm going to talk about one of those.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about the movie I went and saw in the theaters on Friday.
Right.
And that's It Comes at Night.
Right.
Written and directed by Trey Edward Schultz. Now, before I talk about the movie, I'm just going to complain a little bit. And it's got nothing to do with the movie particularly. It's more to do with its distribution company, A24. And now, this movie, I don't know. You haven't seen anything about it, right? You haven't seen ads or anything.
I watched the trailer.
Okay. Very, very mismarketed.
Yeah, the trailer, I gotta admit, the trailer makes me not want to see this movie.
The reason this is mismarketed is because it is marketed as a horror film. It is not a horror film.
Right.
The reason I'm upset about this is because it did not deliver what I expected, but because I'm into more ambiguous, thoughtful, slow burn type movies, I was okay with that.
Yeah.
Whereas a good half or more of the theater was not okay with that.
Yeah.
Because they came into the movie expecting a horror movie, presumably a creature feature.
That's totally how it's marketed.
Which is not what this is. So I heard so many people leaving this movie saying that sucked.
Yeah.
That was terrible. So on and so forth. Now, I think that is a combination of two things. It's a combination of being lied to in the marketing.
Yeah.
And your expectations being, you know, basically crushed underfoot. So you're going to dislike the movie more than you probably would if you knew what it was going in.
Yeah.
And number two, and this is just me complaining as a film fan, like a movie buff, that I feel like a lot of people who went to this are not the kind of people who can handle things not being explained to you full out.
True, but I mean, I saw that trailer.
Right.
First of all, the trailer made me like totally not interested.
But you said the same thing about Get Out.
But secondly, yes, I agree.
And I said the same thing about Get Out,
that
too.
Is also
the trailer
happening.
Made me not want to see it.
But had I gone to this after seeing the trailer,
you would have been annoyed.
I would have been pissed off. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That is me calling out A24 and saying you should not have done that.
Yeah.
I understand you did it because you wanted to make more money.
Yeah.
You did the same kind of thing with The Witch, which you also distributed, is that you kind of mismarketed it slightly.
Yeah.
But you did not mismarket it as bad as you did this. I think it was a deception.
Even the poster, like it totally looks like
I think it was a deception, and I don't think it should have been done. So now we'll talk about the movie.
Okay.
Now, this is a slow burn movie. The basic of this movie is it's about a family headed by Joel Edgerton who lives in a post-apocalyptic world with his wife and teenage son. and they basically have a routine where they're locked in their house and it's boarded up, and they just are on watch to, you know, stay alive and if anyone tries to get into their house.
Okay.
Now, from there, it escalates where someone does try and get in the house. They end up, you know, confronting them, and this person tells them, I have a family. I'm trying to provide for them. Please help me. So basically, that's what happens, is they all end up at this one house, and from there, things kind of escalate with this very looming sense of dread over the whole story and the looming sense of this kind of unexplained virus that's kind of floating through the air at the same time. And that's the basic of the movie. It's basically about people trapped in a house in a post-apocalyptic world and things starting to go very wrong. Okay. I don't want to talk about anything else plot-wise. Now, I can understand if this is marketed as a creature feature, you're expecting a creature feature. What this is it is a bleak drama slash thriller. It's more akin to Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which is a very depressing post-apocalyptic movie. This is what I heard someone call the feel-bad hit of the summer, okay, which I agree with them because it is not a uplifting movie in any sense of the word.
Yeah.
But the thing is that I love these kind of movies.
Right.
I love these movies that are ambiguous, that don't explain everything to you, that let you use your imagination and build your own conclusions.
Okay.
I like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I really am starting to like Joel Edgerton as an actor, because really I might have been aware of him on the periphery of my vision, but it wasn't until I saw The Gift that I took notice of him and said, who is this guy?
Yeah.
I think I like this guy because he wrote, directed, and starred in The Gift.
Yeah.
And then I saw him in this movie called Loving, which is a drama from last year about an interracial couple in the South in the 50s, and he was really good in that too.
Okay.
So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go see this because it looks good and Joel Edgerton's in it and I'm starting to like him. He's really good in this movie too.
Okay.
I really am digging him. He's got a movie on Netflix that he wrote that he co-stars in with Natalie Portman called Jane Got Her Gun, and it's a Western.
Okay.
So I'm kind of curious about that, but he's really good in that. In this movie, he's also in an interracial relationship. The son is a 17-year-old played by Kelvin Harrison Jr., and he's really good in this as well. But it's an all-around solidly acted movie. Throughout the whole movie, there's just this sense of absolute dread on top of it, just layered on top of it. Like, you don't know why, but from the minute it starts, you're like, you have this bad feeling. It's kind of like last year's The Invitation.
Right.
Whereas that movie, throughout the whole movie, you just have this sense of something is going to go wrong. I don't know when, but I'm ready for it.
Yeah.
And that's what this movie did for me too.
Okay.
Where I was cool. Like, something's going wrong in this movie. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I know I'm not going to like it.
Yeah.
And that's what this movie does. It's a very strongly made movie in the sense that there's some really cool cinematography in this. Like you said, there's a lot of the stuff you like the lingering shots.
Yeah.
And the long shots, there's a lot of that in this movie.
Cool.
Where they'll do a shot where it kind of zooms in on one area and sits in that area for like 30 seconds or more.
Nice.
To build like more suspense.
Yeah.
There's a really cool confrontation scene that has a camera spin that I really appreciated. And
yeah.
Like for a low budget movie, it's a very well shot movie. And the reason, like I said, that I really liked this is that I liked being able to have my expectations kind of flipped. And yeah. I know that's partially because of the marketing that it was flipped, but I liked that personally. Yeah. I know I can see why a lot of people didn't, but I did, because when I go into a movie expecting something and then it flips it on me, but it also manages to deliver.
Yeah.
That makes me happy as a film buff.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people I've seen are complaining about the end, whatever. I was fine with it.
Yeah.
But this is a caveat emptor for people, is that if you're going in expecting a horror movie or some sort of creature feature or something along those lines, you're not going to get that. You have to go into this with a realistic, this is a post-apocalyptic drama, basically, yeah, that is very, very depressing.
Okay.
But I really enjoyed it, and I do recommend it if you're into that kind of thing.
Cool. Yeah, I think I'll wait, but I'll check it out.
Yeah, it's worth checking out if you're into those slow burn type of like, you know, all hope is lost type of movies, yeah, in a way. That's what this is. And I really enjoyed it. And I think it's, I think it's getting a lot of shit because of its marketing that it doesn't really deserve as a film.
Right.
Like, I think A24 most definitely deserves the shit they're getting for the marketing, but as a film, I don't think Trey Edward Schultz deserves to be dumped on and lumped in that, because the movie itself is a very good movie.
Cool.
And that's It Comes at Night.
Nice.
Okay.
Okay, I'll get two out of the way here real quick.
Okay.
One's a stupid comedy called Miss March.
Oh, you watched that shit?
From 2009. Dude,
I'm sorry.
Directed by and starring Zach Cregger.
Isn't this one I left at your house?
And Trevor Moore.
Yeah.
So these guys are playing Eugene.
They were, just as a side note, they were part of a comedy troupe called The Whitest Kids You Know, which was a sketch comedy show.
Okay.
On one of the cable networks, and it actually wasn't a terrible show. And that's the reason I watched this, apart from the fact that there was a really hot girl in a bikini on the cover of the Blu-ray.
Yes. I didn't think this was a terrible movie.
Really? I didn't like it.
So okay. So we've got Eugene, who's this guy, and he's like a virgin, and he's about to get laid on his grad night, I believe. And his best friend is named Tucker, played by Trevor Moore, who's super annoying. He's like the typical a little more annoying than normal best friend in a teen sex comedy. Just before Eugene's about to go get deflowered, he is doing shots with Tucker and drinks too much and falls down some stairs and ends up in a coma because he hits his head. So I guess a number of years go by. I'm not sure how many, but he ends up waking up years later and finding out that his girlfriend that he was totally in love with.
Yeah, and she was like super like cock tease.
Yeah, and they were both like pretty like we're not having sex till we're married. Yeah.
And she was like, oh, she wouldn't even let him like make out with her because she was so like hands off.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but a few years later, after he's been in a coma, she's moved on and has decided and has become a Playboy playmate.
Yeah.
Hence the title Miss March. So the two of Eugene and Tucker then decide they're going to travel across the country to the Playboy Mansion to meet her so Eugene can declare his love for her and the fact that he's out of his coma now, and also confront her about why she's become a playmate. So that's the plot.
Yeah, it's like a road trip sex comedy, basically.
Yeah, and I thought it was pretty fucking funny.
I didn't really like this one. I like Sorority Boys that you talked about a couple episodes ago better.
So I like shit jokes.
Yeah, and there's a lot in this.
There's a lot of pooping.
Yeah.
Because every time Eugene gets nervous, he...
shits himself.
He shits himself, like diarrheas himself, which I thought was pretty funny. There's also a pretty hilarious... Oh, God. I feel kind of bad for mentioning this, but it was really funny, and I'm sorry, but Tucker has a girlfriend who's got epilepsy, and there's a blowjob scene in this that involves that's pretty hilarious. We've also got Craig Robinson from Hot Tub Time Machine playing a rap character named Horse Dick.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
.mpeg or something.
Yeah, horsedick.mpeg.
There's crazy firemen chasing them, chasing our characters, which there's one scene where a fire truck or a couple of fire trucks are chasing them, and there's like the firemen are hanging off the trucks with axes and stuff. I thought that was pretty funny. They actually do get to the Playboy Mansion, and I believe it actually is shot at the Playboy Mansion.
I think so, yeah.
Hefner's there. Hefner's there to sort of deliver the Silent Bob moment. And they also, you know, like, if you're familiar with the Playboy Mansion, like, one of the characters, like, is exploring and finds the grotto and stuff, which I thought was pretty fun. I kind of liked it. I wasn't expecting to.
Huh.
Now, it's not my top 10 comedies or anything.
I kind of didn't like it.
So what didn't you like about it?
I just... The thing is, I grew up in the 80s on sex comedies.
Yeah.
And I feel like the newer ones are just trying too hard.
Yeah.
That's my problem. It's like, it's just trying too hard to be like over the top and offensive. And I just didn't, like, there was moments in this I was like, okay, that's kind of amusing. But just as a whole, I found it just was like joke after joke piled on top of each other. And they just stopped working for me after a while.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I did think them going into the epilepsy stuff was a little much. But, you know, I like poop jokes, so hey.
If you're into shit, you're into Miss March.
I just thought it was a lot better than I was expecting.
Right.
for these types of movies.
You said the same thing about Sorority Boys, so
it was. Yeah, maybe
I actually enjoyed Sorority Boys better than this.
Maybe I'm regressing.
Maybe. Okay. Maybe it's like Devo said. Maybe you're de-evolving.
Maybe. Okay. The other sort of mention I'll make is I'm forcing myself to mention these just because. I'll never watch them if I don't. I watched Death Valley, The Revenge of Bloody Bill.
Oh, boy. Good job.
Which is an asylum movie, again. Yeah,
but who's... Is this the... no, it's not. This isn't the John Carl Buechler one, is it? That's Miner's Massacre.
Buechler? No. This is directed by Byron Werner.
Okay, so there's a movie that came out around the same time called Miner's Massacre that's directed by John Carl Buechler, who did the special effects for Friday the 13th, Seven Ghoulies and all that, and it's easy to get them confused. Go ahead. That's right. A bad movie, too.
Yeah, this isn't about a miner. It's about, like, I don't know what it's about, to be honest.
It's about... It was a prospector or something in this.
They're like cowboys or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there is a backstory. I'll be honest.
I barely remember this.
This is one of those movies that I was like watching in like that fucking state of like half awake where you're like not really understanding what's happening. But I then watched the commentary also half awake and I still don't really know what was happening. So that kind of says a lot. So what it is it's this group of kids that are on a debate team that are... going to a debate somewhere, and they run over this black guy who's also a carjacker, and he's really pushy and impatient,
real good stereotype.
Yeah, total stereotype. It's got a terrible theme song. They get to this, like...
What's the full title of this movie?
It's called Death Valley, The Revenge of Bloody Bill.
So that's the theme song. Death Valley,
No, it was that. That would have been better. It was that shitty...
Michael Bolton to sing
it. That shitty, like... You know that shitty metal?
That forward-driving metal that's in most slasher movies from the early 2000s.
Exactly. Yeah. It had that. What else? So the debate team's going, they get carjacked, they go to this town because the carjacker guy's trying to find the money that his partner stole from him, so they end up in this weird, like, ghost town.
Can I just say that every time you say carjacking, I think of the joke in the Brady Bunch movie about carjacking?
What's that joke?
Where the guy's like, where one of the kids is sitting in his car and this thug comes up, he's like, "This is a carjack," and he's like, "Why, this is a car, but my name isn't Jack." Sorry, I was just giggling to myself when you're saying carjack repeatedly.
Right. So they get to the town, and then, like, zombies come. And, you know, I also really hate in low-budget movies when it's fast zombies. I don't think I've ever liked fast zombies.
What about fast zombies with guns?
No, I don't like fast zombies. I love Return of the Living Dead, but even in that, and you know what? Even in Return of the Living Dead, I don't really think of them as fast zombies, even though there's a few scenes where they run out and...
Well, it depends how they're edited.
Yeah, and it's also like, you know, Tarman's not a fast zombie.
No.
But these ones, it's just like people in, you know, the makeup's shitty, so there's just a bunch of people with shitty makeup on running around. So that was super lame. There's also stuff like, you know, there's every fucking room they go in. There's like 500 candles lit. Like, who's lighting all the fucking candles?
The zombies.
No.
They want it to be romantic when they're chomping on guts.
I don't like that stuff because I'm like, really, like, I'm like, there's so many fucking candles in this movie. I don't understand who's lighting them. Or where they're getting the fire from, for that matter. Or where they're even buying the candles, for that matter. Like, are they just constantly lighting the candles? They didn't know the debate team was going to show up there. Fuck off. Okay. And then the other thing is, there's a real pretty blatant ripoff of Friday the 13th Part 2. I think it's Part 2 where you know, like, the one of the characters is trying to reason with Bloody Bill.
Yeah.
So she, like, pretends she's his, like...
Yeah, that's part two,
part two. Yeah. I can't remember if it's like, "I'm trying to pretend I'm your mom or your brother or your fucking dog or whatever," but
that'd be funny. The actress just gets on all fours.
It would have been more entertaining than this shit show. So anyway, not recommended.
All right.
Next.
All right. I'm going to go with the movie that I liked the least out of the ones I'm going to talk about this time, but also I kind of liked for different reasons than it being a good movie.
Oh, man.
I watched 1984 Sheena, starring Tanya Roberts. Yeah. Now, the original Sheena character, it's kind of like a female Tarzan, but it was a comic book character created in 1938.
Yeah.
I guess there was a movie in the 40s for Sheena, like in the late 40s, but this is the one I remember growing up.
Actually, call back to our 3D episode. I think I had a 3D Sheena comic.
Oh, really?
Okay. You're talking about it. Yeah.
Okay. So this was a classic comic book character brought to the screen, and I'm not sure why they decided in mid-84 to do this, because Greystoke, the Legend of Tarzan, was like 3 years before, and I'm like, well, if you're trying to cash in on that, you're a bit late. Tanya Roberts plays Sheena.
Yeah.
She was in Charlie's Angels, obviously. She was in The Beastmaster. She has some really memorable scenes in The Beastmaster, which I got to tell you, dude, she's got some memorable scenes in Sheena.
Does she?
This is a PG-rated movie, but I think Tanya Roberts is more naked in this movie than any other movie she's ever been
really?
In. Really? She's got a scene where she's like bathing herself under a waterfall. She's got a scene where she's like just romping around naked through like this movie. And I just love how this movie is basically just... This movie should be called Sheena, / Bouncing Boobs. Because the opening credits of this movie is Tanya Roberts wearing like a loincloth and a fur bikini, riding on a horse painted to look like a zebra in slow motion with her boobs bouncing while the music, which is a total ripoff of the Chariots of Fire theme, plays in the background.
Nice.
That's the opening credits of Sheena. And this is a 4-minute sequence.
Wow.
Of just her riding with her boobs bouncing, looking at the camera every once in a while. That is the credit sequence. Okay? So this is directed by John Gullerman.
Oh, God.
Who is, if you know who John Gullerman is, you know he's not a very good director.
But he's done some pretty great stuff.
The year after he made, 2 years after he made this, he made King Kong Lives, which is an atrocity.
Right.
And worse than this. At least this movie is kind of...
But what he made King Kong remake as
I know, but he also made King Kong Lives, dude. So they kind of cancel each other out. So the thing is, what this is basically it's about Sheena's an American girl who, when she was a child, her parents went to this native village, this native African village, looking for this like cave, and there's a cave in. Her parents die. She's raised by the African tribe and becomes Sheena. She has the ability to communicate with animals, which she does by putting her hand, kind of curving her hand in and putting it to her forehead and concentrating really hard to communicate to the animals. I'm doing it to Josh, and he can tell you how ridiculous it looks.
Yeah.
And so basically what it is that she's in South Africa. This the brother of the Prime Minister assassinates his brother because he wants the power, and the murder gets put on her tribe mentor that she grew up with. So she has to kind of team up with this American reporter played by what's the guy's name? Ted Wass, to try and
Ted Wass.
Yeah, to stop this to stop this murder while they fall in love, by my dad. So what this is
who's Ted Wass?
I don't know. He was in something or other. I can't remember what. But I think he was in some form of a TV show. I think he was in... I can't remember.
Yeah, okay. Keep going.
Anyway, so he ends up going to the tribe and having to team up with Sheena to try and stop this guy who did the assassination, clear the name of her mentor, and kind of stop the evil government using her animal powers.
Yeah, I remember thinking like... when I watched this, like, why isn't it more like Tarzan?
Yeah,
like,
and she does swing on vines a couple times.
No, but it was way more like about like government corruption.
But the thing is, in this government corruption, though, they know that this reporter has figured out that they assassinated him. So he sends this group of mercenaries to try and kill the reporter and Sheena. And there's a scene where they're running away and they're trying to climb a tree. And he's slipping on the tree. Sheena's ahead of him. She puts her leg down and tells him to grab her leg. And then she lifts him up onto the tree branch using just her leg. It's what? So fucking stupid. So that happens. Then there's all this bad dialogue. There's the Ted Wass character mentioning chemistry when they obviously have no chemistry with each other.
Yeah.
But his character mentions chemistry more than once. She keeps putting her hand to her forehead to call on Beast, which comes in handy, especially when they're kidnapped in a helicopter and she calls on all the flamingos to attack the helicopter in a fucking priceless scene. And like, there's just an ending where it's like basically government, like the army fighting rampaging animals and tribesmen while Sheena's swinging from vines and like putting her hand to her head and calling more animals to come help, like monkeys and elephants and lions. Oh my.
Yeah.
So it's not a good movie.
Yeah. I remember this being terrible.
It's enjoyable for the wrong reasons. So all the stuff I was talking about, you know, the calling the animals, the flamingo attack, the lifting them up with their leg, the swinging from the vines, the naked waterfall scenes, all that stuff, and the fact that Tanya Roberts couldn't act her way out of a paper bag makes this worth seeing once. Also, as a warning, this movie is 1 hour and 57 minutes long.
Oh, man.
Half an hour too long.
Yeah, no doubt.
So kind of painful in that respect. But, you know, I did like an actor called Donovan Scott, who was in the original Police Academy.
Okay.
As Wass's kind of cameraman sidekick. Okay. I enjoyed him in this movie. He was kind of fun. But it's not a good movie. It's not. Like, there was this trend after, like, Indiana Jones and all those to do all these adventure movies in the in the mid-80s. And I remember seeing this on TV when I was a kid and not really remembering much about it apart from a rampaging elephant when I went in to watch it, you know, last week, and it's just not worth it.
No.
Like, unless you're a purveyor of like bad Hollywood movies from the 80s, you should avoid it. But I think it's worth seeing if you're into these kind of crappy culty type movies, because it does have some moments, and it's not that often that you get to see Tanya Roberts' boobs out acting her. So
it's not that often, isn't it? Like every
well, I
movie?
Guess every movie. I mean, according to Jim Wynorski, she's a bitch. So I guess she's not good in this. She has a lot of vacant stares. Let's put it that way. So I don't think there's much going on upstairs, if you know what I'm saying. Yeah,
wasn't she a Bond girl?
I think she was.
Yeah, she was in View to a Kill.
Yeah, I think she was in one of them. But she was also in that 70s show. But the thing the thing is, in that 70s show, she played like a total ditz, so I think it suited her personality, to be honest.
Right.
I just remember her in this, vaguely in Charlie's Angels, because I think she was like in the later seasons of Charlie's Angels.
Yeah.
And I remember her in Sins of Desire.
Oh, yeah, Sins of Desire.
And Inner Sanctum, which were like the Fred Olen Ray and Wynorski erotic thrillers.
I think she was in like one of the Night Eyes movies.
Yeah, I don't remember. She's just not very
good. Or like one of those, like, yeah, Inner Sanctum or something. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, Sheena's not worth seeing. The only other thing I want to quickly mention trivia-wise is that there was a TV show in 2000 called Sheena that ran for 2 seasons starring Gina Lee Nolan.
Oh.
From Baywatch. So I'm curious if it's better than this. I don't think it'd be that hard to be better than this. But if you want to see a Hollywood studio disaster from the mid-80s, Sheena's your bet.
All right. I don't know if I'd want to see a TV version because there'd be no naked waterfall stuff.
That's true, but you also have to slug your way through 1 hour and 57 minutes of this movie. Thankfully, right. That stuff's fairly early, so you could like just get to the waterfall scene and turn it off and be good.
Yeah, I think I do. Now that you mention it, I seem to remember waiting for another scene like the waterfall. It never happened.
Well, like her first nude scene is pretty early.
Yeah.
But then the next, there's 2 nude scenes, and the second nude scene's not that long afterwards. And
yeah, and then nothing else.
The thing that stuns me is that I'm watching it, right? And these scenes come up, and I pick up the back of the box, and I'm like, PG? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember she also has a topless scene in Beastmaster, and that was PG, but this is a bit more gratuitous than Beastmaster is. So,
but then you're expecting that third one, and it never happens.
I guess so. It's not very good.
All right.
I'm sure it's better than any Tarzan movie starring Bo Derek, but...
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, the Bo Derek Tarzan movie is terrible,
No. No.
You're saying it's not?
I respectfully disagree.
Oh, wow. Okay.
If we're going with... It depends how you watch it, man.
Okay.
It's kind of like what you're just saying about Sheena. If you're watching Sheena for a good hour or 2 hour movie, adventure
movie,
you're not
getting it. No.
But if you're watching it for the leg lifting and the flamingos, hand on the forehead and the boobs and stuff, then it's good.
It's not good.
Well, it's it's different.
I don't want to trick anyone to thinking this is a good
movie. I know,
but
it's like if you watch Richard Harrison in Tarzan the Ape Man for more of a like comedic point of view,
right?
It's fucking hilarious.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
All right.
I got two more. What do you got?
I have three more.
All right.
Citadel.
Okay.
From 2012 again. I guess
I kind of want to see this one too.
2012 kind of mood. This is directed by Kieran, I think it's Kieran Foy, an Irish director. He went on to do Sinister 2, and I don't know what else. I think
Sinister 2 is his last movie.
Yeah, I think something else is coming, but I'm not sure. Anyway, this is a killer kid movie.
Another one?
Yeah. I know, right? And I kind of knew it was, and but this is one of the best ones I've seen in a long time. This had really, really good, cool killer kids in this, and they were like mutant kids,
kind of like the Children, right? Comparable to the Children.
But these were mutants, like they were fucked up. They were like the baby, and or that they were like the little kid at the end of Phenomena or Creepers.
Oh, okay,
you know that fucked up kid.
Okay,
they kind of reminded me of that guy, except they had hoodies on. So it opens with an attack at a project. Like, it was kind of like a project. I mean, the project's like, you know, remember in Candyman, like those big abandoned, like, project.
Right, yeah.
Apartment buildings.
Yeah.
Like, it was kind of that type of landscape and that kind of building. So it did remind me of Candyman right away.
Kind of like those, like, rundown, like, apartment buildings kind of.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, like big city apartment buildings. Yeah. So it opens up with an attack, like, in the first, like, minute. And it's a guy played by Aneurin Barnard, playing a guy named Tommy. It's him and his girlfriend, or his pregnant girlfriend, and he goes down this elevator because it looks like they're moving away or something. Goes down this elevator, goes back up. The elevator has a window on it, and when he gets back up to his floor to pick up his girl, he can see through the window of the elevator, but the elevator gets stuck, so he can't leave, and he has to watch as these like little fucked up mutant children kill his girlfriend.
That sounds pretty cool.
Well, they attack his girlfriend.
That sounds like it'd be cool.
It's a super cool opening.
Yeah,
and this is like the first minute, so I'm not spoiling anything. I guess some time passes, and we learn that he's totally messed up from this. He becomes an agoraphobic, which means he's afraid to go outside. He's trying to like raise this kid, like this little baby, by himself. So he's a single dad. He's all messed up. He's all sweaty. He's all freaked out. And then a lot of the streets are quite abandoned, and like he hears noises, and there's a lot of cool like camera tricks and use of sound and use of angles and stuff that really bring up the sense of dread, but you really feel it in this guy more than I've seen in a long time. Like, this guy is like a basket case, but you're kind of with him, like feeling like a basket case yourself. Really, 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 really effective that way. He's going to like a group to try and like get over his fear and stuff, but he then runs into this foul-mouthed priest who basically tells him that he says they're coming for your, you know, they're coming for your baby next. So this priest somehow knows that these weird feral kids are gonna go after this guy's baby next. So the guy obviously starts becoming more and more paranoid, and yeah, just a lot of stuff where he's like, you know, in the house with his baby and just hearing noises, lights go out, he's all freaked out, and yeah, really cool.
Well, it totally plays off that where, like, if you're home alone when you were a kid, right?
Yeah.
You always thought you were hearing noises or that someone was in the garage or,
yeah, you know, but what makes like this different is you rarely see any other characters.
Right.
Like, it's this weird world, but it's almost like he's the only one living. So
they're building up the isolation factor
there. Very, very isolated, even though I think it's like a well, I area feel like of
if
the
you're
city.
Agoraphobic, you're already isolated.
Yeah, but, with, right? But it's like the area of the city that's being, like, revamped, but you never really see any other people. Except
so it's like right before they're about to gentrify an area or something where everyone's kind of moved out.
Yeah, and, like, honestly, I think the only time you see other people is in, like, if it's in a building, like if he's in the hospital or if he's in group or if he's like, getting like, a
prescription. But never really in the apartment.
But never if he's, like, walking on the street. The only other person you see is, like, a bus driver.
Okay, that's kind of a neat touch then.
Yeah, and then he, you know, he makes a friend and, like, you know, she's trying to help him and stuff. But, yeah, it just builds up eventually he, like, sort of teams up with the priest to try and take on these...
kind of becomes a siege movie, right?
Take on these kids. Doesn't really become a siege movie. It becomes... as the movie wears on, pretty much all... This is, again, this really isn't a spoiler, but his baby gets taken and he's got to, like, try and get it back. Okay. So, but yeah, it's really good. I didn't really know much about this other than... I heard that this was based on the director actually had an incident where he was attacked by kind of a kid gang.
Yeah, because in Europe, like in England and Ireland, that they have the hoodie gangs.
Yeah,
and which you've seen in like a movie like Eden Lake too.
Yeah,
kind of similar where it's like
them ills. Yeah,
yeah, it's the hoodlums with the hoodies, and you know that's why they in some areas of Britain they. Don't allow teenagers to wear hoodies and stuff because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually a bit of a subgenre, like hoodie horror, they call
yeah.
it. So.
Cause my girlfriend thinks I look pretty evil when I wear hoodies.
I think hoodies look pretty evil.
Yeah.
So what was I saying before? I can't remember. Sorry, you jumped in. I totally lost my train of thought. Anyway, it's really effective. So I just would
you were saying that the director talked about
right,
personal experience.
The director had been attacked by this gang of
hoodlums.
Hoodie kids
yep.
when he was a kid and got smashed in the head with a hammer and he became an agoraphobic. So this is pretty autobiographical as well as throughout what his experience was. I mean, not totally, but I think he was exercising a lot of personal demons while making this. So that's pretty cool as well. Yeah, it's really well made. One of the more effective thrillers and one of the more effective lead performances. This guy really sold you on the like whole paranoia thing and you... It really scared me. And actually, there were some scenes that really made me jump in this. And these creatures were messed up, dude. Like, they were, like, really freaky looking. So, yeah, I totally recommend this as well. So if you are interested in this, I know this is coming off Netflix in the next few days.
Okay.
So I'd recommend checking it out.
I am interested in it.
Yeah.
But I might just buy it.
There you go. I don't know if it's a Well, yeah, I might check it out again. It's pretty cool. This is a cool flick.
All right, cool.
Yeah, Citadel.
All right, so for my next one, I actually, after we recorded our underrated 70s episode, I did note some of the movies, and I've slowly started picking them up, and I bought one of the ones that you actually recommended.
Right.
Called The Seven Ups.
Yeah.
From 1973.
Great.
Directed by Philip D'Antoni.
Yeah.
Now this is a movie that came out 2 years after he produced The French Connection, and I think because of that, this movie gets compared to The French Connection.
Yeah,
an awful
it's
lot.
Pretty hard not to.
And it's also I was comparing it to The French Connection a little bit.
Yeah,
admittedly,
you can't do that
when I was watching it. So the basic plot about this movie, it's set in 70s New York, which automatically makes it worth seeing because you're never going to see anything like 70s New York ever again.
Yeah.
It's just a fascinating time frame and a fascinating, you know, area to be in. Basically what it is Roy Scheider is a cop who has a team of like, you know, fellow cops who they kind of like team together to bust crime rings.
They're like a task force.
Yeah, they're like a task force. And in this movie, it's kind of like he gets part of this kind of involved in this plot where it's like a kidnapping plot.
kidnapping of mob bosses.
Yeah, kidnapping of mob bosses. And he has to try and figure out who's doing it and how he's going to solve this crime. And he uses his task force to do it. And basically, it's kind of a police procedural, but not heavily on that, leaning on that. I think French Connection leans on the police procedural a bit more than this does, to be honest. What this is it's... I found this movie was... Plot-wise, I found it a bit confusing at times.
Yeah, it was.
Like, because there wasn't really quite a lot of development on any of the characters. Especially, like, I thought the Roy Schneider character was not really developed that much, which I kind of was like, well, this is the hero of your movie. I feel like I should know a little bit more about him.
Yeah.
Like, he was a cool guy and everything, but he's no... He's obviously no, you know, Popeye Doyle from French Connection. But I liked this movie in the sense that it was mostly scenes. Like, I was willing to overlook the plot being a little bit off for me just because there was so many cool moments in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, this has a really cool car chase in it, which is probably its most famous scene.
Yeah.
It's got this really... there's this scene that I really dug involving a car wash.
Yeah.
Where they're like, they're going to steal the money out of the back of this mob car in a car wash. And I thought the way that was staged was really cool.
Yeah.
Richard Lynch, who's a big cult actor, he's been in a lot of stuff you've probably seen, like some of the Trancers movies and things like that. He's in this as like a kind of a hitman. And I thought he was really good in this.
Yeah.
Like, I thought he was really... He played that up perfectly because he was like, you knew he was crazy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he'd be like talking to the guys who hired him and being like kind of sarcastic with him. Like, oh yeah, you want me to just step away and do that? And he'd like kind of smile at him and say, okay, I can do that. And then he wouldn't do it.
Right.
You know, things like that. There was some pretty good interplay between Schneider and his task force near the beginning where they're in the locker room talking about, you know, what they were going to do on the weekend and stuff after they had done this big bust.
And I really like that opening scene.
I thought that scene was really good because I would have wished there was a bit more character development like that.
Yeah.
Because I thought that scene really worked for me because I'm like, okay, he's got his crew and they're, you kind of are getting to know their crew a little bit and see how they can interact with each other. In the room, they've got this, this blind hanging by the window that says, "Be careful by window, sniper sighted," or something, which I thought was funny.
Yeah.
Just stuff like little touches like that. But it's like I said, I just found the plot to be confusing. That was the main drawback for me.
Yeah, it was a little confusing.
Like, I wish the plot would have been a little bit more streamlined, and I think this would have been a really kick-ass movie.
Yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong. This is worth seeing if you're into police procedural type of movies or this kind of 70s cop movies. Because I think it's a pretty good 70s cop movie.
Yeah.
I feel like it was hard to disconnect it from the French Connection, which I wish I could have been able to, because then I wouldn't have been thinking about, you know.
So why were you thinking of that so much?
Just because I knew that, well, because same kind of setting.
Yeah.
Car chase.
Right.
Because car chase is what is the most memorable scene from this movie, and it was a big deal in French Connection.
Yeah.
And just the fact that the guy who directed this was the producer in French Connection, you could tell he took inspiration from that movie and brought it into this one.
And Schneider, I guess.
And Schneider. But he's, you know, he's not William Friedkin. You know, he doesn't.
No,
have,
but Roy Scheider's.
No, you know what I mean, but.
He's.
Philip D'Antoni is not William Friedkin.
No, but Scheider's Hackman's partner. So, I mean, it's kind of like you're watching Hackman's partner.
I guess so, in a way. Yeah. I didn't think of it that way.
Like, that's how I would see you being, like, being, thinking of it as part, as the French Connection world.
Yeah. It could be taken that way. I didn't really look at it that way. But the problem is, too, is that I feel like French Connection's pretty much the perfect 70s cop movie.
Yeah.
So, I feel like I was comparing them a bit too much than I should have been. But don't get me wrong. Like I said, 7-Ups is an entertaining flick. It's got a lot of stuff I liked in it. It's got a lot of cool action sequences. It's got those moments in the car wash. It's got a moment where they're kind of tailing the cops after going to this like wake that I thought was really cool. And, you know, I like Roy Schneider as an actor. I thought he was fairly engaging in this, although I wish I would have got to know his character a bit better than they let me. And Richard Lynch was awesome. Yep. So if you're into 70s cop movies, you know, check this one out. You can get it for cheap. You can get it for like under $10 on DVD. So,
I know, it's crazy.
So give it a look. I mean, I'm glad I saw it, and I hadn't heard about it till you mentioned it, and you know, I'm glad I went and paid the money and watched it. And I mean,
yeah,
I,
the car chase is epic in this. Like, it's like 15 yeah, minutes long.
It's a great car chase. I mean, I don't think this is a movie I'm going to revisit.
Yeah,
but I mean, I'm glad I saw it.
Yeah,
because I'm not as into cop movies as you are, like 70s cop movies, admittedly, yeah. But I like them enough that when I see one that I've never heard of,
yeah,
and it delivers on some aspects that I'm looking forward to, I'm happy. So nice. I was happy with this movie, but like I said, unfortunately, it's no French Connection, and I couldn't get that out of my head when I was watching yeah. it.
All right. Well, I watched Chacma.
You watch Chacma? I was wanting to see Chacma. Peace? No, you have two left, right?
Two left.
Okay.
One left after Chacma.
Okay. I always wanted to see Chacma.
Yeah, well, I saw it.
And? I've heard it's pretty amusing.
I don't know what to say about this one. Okay. So
that's a bad sign right off the bat.
It's from 1990. Somehow it took two directors to make this, Hugh Parks and Tom Logan. So it's like a medical school, and they're doing tests on animals, including the baboon named Chacma. And the opening,
I think I just like the name more than anything.
The opening scene is like a brain operation. Roddy McDowell is like doing surgery on a baboon, mm-hmm. and it's like Saw 4 style brain surgery, mm-hmm. where it's Saw 3, like it's
Saw pretty, 4,
Saw 3, the end of Saw 3.
Oh, okay.
I'll never forget it.
Okay.
But it's pretty graphic, like close up baboon brain surgery, and then he puts this like syringe of stuff into the baboon, and then they end up deciding that, and then they end up putting the baboon down, or so they think.
Chacma.
But after they do the surgery, they then decide they're going to do this like D&D style role-playing game in the building after hours.
Wicked.
Where they're all like assigned there's I guess 5 or 6 students, and they're all assigned like a role. And then they're supposed to find clues throughout the building. And then Roddy McDowell, their teacher, is actually the dungeon master type character who's like running this game. Yeah, I was not expecting this at all, dude.
Okay. I'm in so far.
So he's running the game from a computer. And so, like, off they go. And so the cast...
So he's, like, in a control room?
Kind of
pressing buttons and acting like the Wizard of Oz?
But it's, like, a shitty, like, early, like 1990 computer.
TRS-80.
Yeah. We've got Christopher Atkins running around as part of the...
Blue Lagoon?
He's one of the students. Blue Lagoon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We've got Amanda Wiss.
Oh, yeah.
From Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
Ari Myers, don't really know her. She played a younger girl. She was on Kate and Allie for a number of years.
All right.
And a couple of other actors.
Totally in right now.
Token black guy. Token like loud mouth preppy asshole.
You
guy.
Said token black guy and token preppy, and I'm still in, man. I'm still in.
So they start playing the game, and then
Chacma,
the baboon.
Is it like a undead baboon?
I don't think so.
So I'm assuming it's the baboon that he was doing the brain surgery. It's
the baboon that Roddy McDowell was doing the surgery on.
Yeah.
And it goes...
Malpractice gone
fucking
wrong.
Fucking ape shit.
Ape, I get it.
No, this...
Baboon shit.
Baboon. So the baboon is like, goes fucking ballistic.
Okay.
And it starts attacking people. Okay.
How does Roddy McDowell possibly put this as part of the game?
So Roddy McDowell is like doing his controlling, and then like they've all got little like things on them, like homing devices, so he can see where all the characters are, and then like one of them disappears.
That's pretty fucking elaborate.
So then the rest of them are like, oh, where's so and so? But they think, you know, but they're still playing the game, so they're like, some, you know, someone will be like, come with me, it's not safe, right? But the other guy thinks it's a trick because they're playing the game, right? So he doesn't listen. So there's that type of stuff going on. But this fucking monkey or baboon dude, like when it goes after people, it like screams and like runs down the hall after them, and then like they'll run behind a door and it's like it's jumping and smashing on the door.
Dude, I'm fucking
like it's crazed.
In.
Like the thing is crazed.
I'm so in right now.
And I just didn't understand how they got this out of this monkey. Like I'm like it is so like in a frenzy to get at people. It's just smashing itself on doors, and it can't be an effect, right? Like this is 1990. This ain't no CGI. This is a freaking baboon, and it looks really crazy and freaky. It's got weird crimped hair and its red ass flapping around, and yeah, it's pretty entertaining. And then you've got, like, you know, they've got stupid shit like Atkins, because he's the guy who, like, you know, had a bit of a bond with Shakma before he got the brain surgery. So he'll be, like, you know, he'll go into a room and Shakma will be there, like, snarling at him. And Atkins will be like, sit, Shakma, stay. Shakma is like, fuck that, and jumps Shakma's at him.
Like, fuck you, Blue Lagoon.
But the scenes of it jumping on the walls was just crazy. And
fuck yeah. You, Blue Lagoon. Shakma, don't listen.
This monkey, yeah, went bananas.
Dude, I'm sold.
Okay, so, yes, I get why you're sold. Now, the only thing is...
Oh, shit, there's a butt.
There's a bit of a butt. A red butt. sorry, Shakma. But
he'll fucking kill you, dude.
He will. I'd be scared shitless if I saw this fucker down the hall.
If Shakma came running down the hall at you and you're trying to run to your department, you're like, I'm sorry, I bought so many fucking movies today.
Okay, but the only thing about it is that you run away and you close the door, you're good. Shakma's not going to get you anymore. So that's what I didn't
understand. Does he give up after a while?
He'll just jump in at the wall for a
and
while.
And then he's like, I'm bored.
And then he kind of disappears for a while, like, yeah. Later in the movie. Like, all of a sudden, like, they're walking around on the floor, like, looking for...
Isn't Shakma smart enough to go through the vents?
Well, I don't know. Like, but, like, it's just weird. Like, they're on the floor, Shakma's on. Earlier scenes, whenever they go onto the floor, Shakma's running at them, screeching and jumping at the door. But then later, they'll be walking around on the floor, and he's nowhere to be seen. So I don't know what Shakma was doing
at
that time.
Take a pee break.
But the problem is like, it's a building with multiple floors, right? So if they're on floor 4 and Shakma's on floor 3, they're totally safe. So my big issue with this movie is I'm
wow,
just
you
like...
you really broke this down.
Well, I'm just like, don't go on floor fucking 3, dumbass. Like, why would you go on floor 3 when you know Shakma's there? Go on floor 2. Go on floor 1. Like, don't go on floor 3. You know he's there. You're good. Or, like, lock Shakma in the stairwell. Like, all you have to do is close the door and you're okay. Right? But nope. They got to go keep going where he is just so there's action.
So, like, you're saying if they went and, like, hid out in a room with the door shut, they'd be safe till the
They're
morning?
They're fine. You're good. Close the door. Shakma's not getting in. I remember when I was in this apartment and I had this fucked up cat staying with me. You remember this?
Yeah,
Danzig the cat. And, yeah, if I opened the door... I stepped out of the room, my bedroom, this fucker would scream at me and run towards me. So I just closed the door. It's all good. Now, getting out of my bedroom to the front door was a problem, right? Because I had to go by this crazy motherfucker. But the thing is, once, Shakma. If I was able to, now I was not able to because I was too freaked out of the cat. Okay, I'm sounding like a real sissy here, but you don't understand. But if I had gotten to the front door...
And shut the door, you'd be fine.
It's all good. I would have had to get rid of the cat somehow, but I'm safe. So I wouldn't then keep going back into my room over and over again. And that's what they do in the movie. Like, they just keep going back. So that was my issue with the movie. So if you can, like, get past the periods of time where they're, like, not in the room with Shakma and then going... we're not in the room with Shakma right now. We're safe. Let's talk for 5 minutes. Let's go back in the room with Shakma now just because we need some action. If you're okay with those interludes, you'll enjoy this.
Okay.
I got a kick out of it.
I'm borrowing this from you. I need to see some Shakma
so
in my life.
I think this is from Code Red, I think. So it's either Code Red or Scorpion. So it's a little more difficult to come by, but... It's worth a look.
I think I need some shock.
It's worth a look.
All right. Well, I'm going to talk about a movie that I love now.
All right.
And this is a movie that I remember first seeing back in 1987 when they were doing their... Remember back in the day they used to have the Super Channel free weekends?
Yeah.
So what this was it's kind of like, you know how you have movie channels these days? Back when they were first starting out in the 80s, they used to give free weekends to everybody.
Oh, yeah, I love
that. Where it would start like Friday night and go till Sunday evening. Mm. And I used to just fucking tape everything or just sit there and watch everything, yeah. You know? That's how I saw The Kindred and how I saw Critters and how I saw Maximum Overdrive and right. things like that. And that's how I saw this fucking movie originally. And this is a movie from 1986 that I'd like to call Trick or Treat.
Oh, nice. You watched it finally.
Now, thanks for that, Josh. Yeah. I mean, so the story behind Trick or Treat is it's always had a shitty release in North America.
Yeah,
it's always been full frame DVD. The DVD's always been expensive. I never watched the DVD even though I had it because I was like, I'm not watching this fucking movie in full frame. Well, once Josh and I acquired region free Blu-ray players, he decided to get me the German import of Trick or Treat for Christmas, and
yeah.
I finally got my region free player set up in a way that I was comfortable using it, and I was like, oh, fucking christening this shit with Trick or Treat.
Nice. Under its alternate title,
Ragman.
Yeah.
And the reason it's called Ragman is because the main character's nickname is Ragman.
Oh, okay.
But this movie is fucking awesome, dude.
Really?
Awesome.
Still?
I fucking love Trick or Treat. Okay?
Yeah, it's a good flick. I liked it quite a bit.
I'm going to tell you why I love Trick or Treat. This is a heavy metal movie, for starters.
Yeah.
This movie came out when I was totally into metal. Yeah. I'm talking Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, all those kind of bands. And so the basic of the story is Mark Price, who played Skippy on Family Ties,
yeah.
plays a guy called Eddie Weinbauer. And he's kind of like a lowly metalhead. So the opening scenes of this movie show him like at school getting picked on, you know, by the preppy guys and everything. Like there's a scene where he's in the locker room and, you know, the preppies take his metal tape out of his locker and are like throwing it keep away from him, and they throw it out into the gym, and as he's going out after his tape, they pull his towel off so he's naked in front of the girls' volleyball team and stuff like that. So he's like, you know, he's picked on, your typical outcast kind of thing. You know, they'll punch a hole in his chocolate milk, and when he goes to drink it, it pours all over the front of his shirt, and they laugh at him and all that kind of stuff. You know, your typical 80s high school antics. Meanwhile, in the background, there's this awesome soundtrack playing by the band Fastway.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Fast Eddie Clark, who was in Motorhead, is the guitarist in this band.
Yeah.
And
Pete Way is also in the band.
Yeah. So what this is he's this metalhead. He's picked on. He's obsessed with this rocker called Sammy Kerr.
Yeah.
Who used to actually go to their high school, and he's due to come back and play like the Halloween dance, you know, because he's like, I want to go back to where I went to high school and play the Halloween dance. But he's got all this controversy because he's like one of those shock rockers, you know, like he'll be on stage like biting the head off a snake and pouring the snake blood all over him and stuff.
Yeah.
And he dies in a hotel fire. So Eddie's obviously distraught about this, and he goes and visits this DJ called Nuke at the local radio station, played by Gene Simmons from Kiss.
Right.
Who's like, yeah, I know you're upset, but guess what? I got the Sammy Kerr album that's right. unreleased, and I'm going to give it to you so you can listen to it. And I'm going to play it on Halloween night as a premiere, but you can take it and listen to it. So Eddie goes home, plays the record. There's backmasked messages on it. He starts playing it backwards, brings back Sammy Kerr as an entity who fucks everybody up who messes with Eddie. Nice. Basically. So what this is this is what I'd like to call a heavy metal version of Freddy Krueger, because they're totally trying to cash in on the popularity of Freddy in this movie.
Right.
So Sammy Kerr, when he comes out, he's a metal guy. He's got the spiky hair. He's got like the ripped mesh tops and everything. And he's got half his face burned off because of the hotel fire.
Right.
He's got the long fingernails. He can jump through electricity waves like Shocker can. This is pre Shocker though. And it's totally like Nightmare on Elm Street in that sense, because he's jumping between these electricity waves and attacking people. There's a scene in this movie where he goes through a Walkman tape to basically rape a girl.
Really?
Yeah, like there's a scene where this girl's making out with the preppy guy, and she like he goes, I gotta take a pee, so he leaves while they're in the middle of a makeout session, and she puts on the headphones with this cassette tape, and she's listening to it, and she's getting into it, and this green mist comes out of the Walkman headphones and basically takes her top off. And, like, you see the form a hand and start pulling down her her panties and stuff.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Seriously. And then this big monster shows up. It's fucking awesome, I gotta say. So the reason I love this movie is because I was a metalhead. I felt picked on. This is my movie.
Nice.
You know? And... You know, Lisa Orgolini, who hasn't been in much else, is like this girl that Eddie's got a crush on, who's like kind of she's super cute and she like super understands him. Like, oh, the preppies pick on you. You know, they're assholes. Kind of like that kind of character. You know, and once Sammy Kerr's unleashed, you know, people start dying, obviously. Doug Savant plays the preppy bully, and he nails it. He's your typical 80s preppy bully. You know, he's got the sweater on, and he's, like, smarmy.
Savant, like the gay guy from Melrose Place?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And he nails it in this movie. He's, like, such an asshole to Eddie. And, you know, I love it in the 80s movies when they nail the preppy like this, because you're like, I don't remember preppies like this when I went to school, but I fucking hate them in these movies.
Yeah.
And he nails it, right? What else do we got here? I got a few notes because I'm so excited about this movie, I gotta tell you. there's a bunch of mild satire. Like, there's a scene early in the movie where Sammy Kerr's in front of like a PMRC meeting talking about how everyone's wrong about heavy metal and we're gonna take our revenge on you. And there's another scene later in the movie where Ozzy Osbourne has a cameo as like a priest who's saying how heavy metal music is evil and stuff.
Right.
And
I remember the Ozzy thing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And once Sammy Kerr comes back, you know, he's leaping through everything. He ends up at the Halloween dance playing this really fucking awesome tune before he starts shooting lightning bolts out of his guitar at people and everything. I'm like, this is the best movie I've ever seen. The guy who played Sammy Kerr is an actor called Tony Fields.
Yeah.
Now, this is notable because he was a Solid Gold dancer, and he's mostly known as a dancer. He's really great in this. He's really cool. He has this really cool dance scene. Unfortunately, he died really young. I think he was like 38, and he died of AIDS.
Okay.
And it's a sad story, but he's really good in this movie. Like, I would have taken Sammy Kerr in a sequel to this movie gladly because he's just so cool. There's a cool scene with a car that gets possessed. The Halloween party scene, like I told you, is pretty awesome. And it's just an all-around fucking fun movie. Like, that's the thing. Like, this movie has no pretenses to be anything but an entertaining movie.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't try to be a scary movie particularly. It's just like, you know what? Freddy's popular right now. Let's fucking go for it. Let's try and make the most ridiculous movie we can possibly think of and just go for it, right?
Yeah.
Notable for being directed by Charles Martin Smith. Who's actually known as an actor mostly. This is his debut movie as a director. He also directed Air Bud, unfortunately. But he's a guy who was in both American Graffiti movies and Starman. So he actually handles the material really cool. And this is just one of those movies that came out in the 80s where every time I put it on, I'm just like, this is a great movie. And I hadn't seen it for like, God, at least 15 years when I watched it.
Yeah.
And I fucking love this movie.
Awesome.
Love it. And if you have a region-free player, I highly recommend you pick up this German Blu-ray from MSG, I think it's called, or something along those lines, is the company. Because I don't see this movie coming out in North America on Blu-ray, simply because I feel like there's probably going to be rights issues with music.
Yeah.
But it's a great flick. If you're into this kind of thing, high recommendation.
I'm so surprised this hasn't come out, like, music rights or not. Like,
this movie has a cult following.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're into that kind of 80s horror movie that had like kind of like wanted to have an iconic villain who was like really cool and like kind of crack jokes, but also like really cool effects and just death scenes and stuff, give this one a spin.
Yeah, I remember really enjoying
it. I fucking
this.
Love
yeah.
Trick or Treat. And I'm really happy that you got it for me and that I got to see it in widescreen finally.
It's got a sweet cover too.
So fucking good, dude. So good.
Awesome. All right.
Josh's VHS Adventures!
Yes. What an adventure it was. I watched a movie called Black Gauntlet.
Oh.
From 1974.
Oh.
So this is directed by...
Preach it.
This is directed by Chris Munger.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I couldn't yell out a director's name this time. Sorry, dude.
So he directed a movie called Kiss of the Tarantula.
Okay.
Which is, it was on that, you know that Ruby?
I've seen that.
Double feature in that Ruby disc.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet. I watched Ruby, but I haven't watched Kiss of the Tarantula yet.
Yeah, it's like a tarantula revenge movie.
Yeah, it's like a,
not the tarantulas getting revenge, but I think no, someone.
It's like a teen girl who like has powers over tarantulas using them to get revenge.
Yeah, something like that.
You know, one of those type. One of those Carrie kind of knockoffs.
Yeah. Okay, so this is like... Okay, so this is like one of these cautionary tales.
All right.
Of like a young woman...
Okay.
Trying to make it in Hollywood.
Oh.
And what can go wrong.
Nice.
So it's one of those movies.
All right.
So I'm trying to think of something. I don't know what I can compare it to. Like something like Day of the Locust, maybe, or like... It's one of those, like, yeah, those rise and fall.
Isn't that movie Streets with Christina Applegate kind of like that from 1990?
Maybe. I know I'm missing, like, some.
Yeah, there's some of those. I know what you're talking about. It's those total, like, I'm a small town girl who's going to go to Hollywood and make it in acting, but I've fallen on Skid Row in rough times.
Yeah, it's kind of like what Hollywood Boulevard is spoofing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this one's playing it straight.
Okay.
In a blaxploitation type of way.
Fuck yes.
Okay. Don't say
fuck yes yet.
Okay, this is also AKA Black Starlet.
You see, I say that, like, I get excited that you say it's like blaxploitation, but I'm fully aware that a good half of the blaxploitation movies are not good.
Okay, so this is a blaxploitation movie. I'll just get this part out of the way first.
Okay.
So this is a blaxploitation movie filled with a cast of, like, B-level blaxploitation stars.
Okay.
So there ain't no Fred Williamson in this.
All right.
There ain't no Pam Grier.
There ain't no Isaac Hayes.
There ain't no Isaac Hayes.
So no Rudy Ray Moore even.
No Rudy Ray Moore.
And that's like scraping the barrel on the blaxploitation.
So our lead is Juanita Brown.
Okay.
Playing Clara.
All right.
And she's the woman in question who like wants to make it. So she's now Juanita Brown... was one of the leads in Caged Heat, so we'll give her that. She also did appear in Foxy Brown and Willie Dynamite.
Now, is she really sassy in this movie?
She's a kind of a bitch in this movie. She's got a real attitude.
All right.
A real but not that kind of attitude.
All right.
It's more like, don't fuck with me, that type of attitude.
That's really going to get her far with agents.
Yeah. So we've also got she befriends a guy named Ben,
okay,
played by Rockne Tarkenton. And now I know him
that
best.
That's familiar to me.
I know him best from a movie called Black Samson.
Okay, yeah.
So this guy who wears like this robe and carries around a big fucking stick. Yeah. That's a pretty fun movie, but he hasn't been in tons either. Her boyfriend at the beginning of the movie is named Scully. He's played by Damu King. Again, like, hasn't really been in much, but he was in Black Godfather. That's kind of your main cast.
Did you say Black Godfather?
Yeah.
I got that movie at home. I've never watched it.
Okay, well, Damu King's in that.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, yeah, like, as you can see, it's kind of, this is truly like a blaxploitation, like a B movie of the blaxploitation genre.
It's more like a C movie, a Z movie.
Yeah.
Of the blaxploitation.
Like, honestly, I feel quite fortunate to have stumbled across this.
Okay.
In my jumbo video, you know, treasure hunt days. That was a chain up here from years and years ago. I bought a lot of stuff there. Okay, so the movie opens up in a strip bar with some funky music and a bar fight. So, I mean, I was pretty into it right away. Juanita's not happy.
Of course not.
But, you know, she's got her boyfriend, Scully, and she's like, you know, I just want to make it in Hollywood. And he says, you're sweet, you're beautiful, and you're black. So, you know, he's trying to, like, pick her up. But, you know, she's not having it. She's like, no, I got to go do it on my own. So she goes to Hollywood to try and make it. She, you know, shit starts happening right away. You know, she comes across this motorcycle cop who, like, harasses her. You know, he basically is implying that she's a hooker when she's waiting at a bus stop. Motorcycle cop, by the way, is played by Nicholas Worth. He's a character actor. He's been in tons of shit, like Swamp Thing and Dark Man.
Is that the guy who was in Dark Angel, The Ascent also?
Oh, you're right. He might have been.
He's like a bald.
Yeah, he's bald.
That guy's pretty awesome.
Been in tons of shit.
Yeah.
So he was a white guy.
He was the guy in Darkman who Liam Neeson wore his mask and they like ran into each other.
I think they were
looking at each other all shocked, and then Liam Neeson started, his character started, his mask started to melt.
Right.
Yeah. That guy's awesome.
He is pretty awesome. So, you know, that guy plays a white asshole cop who like harasses her.
Does he have hair?
Hmm?
Does he have hair in this movie?
He has a helmet on, so you can't tell. Okay, but he like calls her Black Beauty and stuff. Like racism. Al Lewis shows up as like
Grandpa?
Grandpa Munster.
Grandpa Munster?
Yeah. I actually was tired when I wrote this, so I can't read my note. So she moves to Hollywood. She eventually meets a friend, a white friend named Jane. They start going to parties and stuff. And, you know, of course, like the first party they go to, every guy's hitting on them. There's fucking drugs everywhere. Of course, Juanita starts doing blow like right away. But like the thing is, like every guy she meets other than Rockney is a fucking asshole. Like all they want is to get laid. Like no matter what's coming out of their mouth, they're just trying to fuck her.
Okay.
And they all do. So like it's like they'll be saying, well, yeah, you're totally gonna get this part, but you know they're just trying to fuck her. And so it's really kind of showgirlsy that way, because I know my love of Showgirls doesn't rub off on you, but it's the same kind of thing in Showgirls, where every guy in Showgirls is a total dick other than Robert Davi. I thought he was pretty cool in that, but it goes on, and then eventually she does fuck her way to the top. It's pretty sad, like, cause, you know, she keeps trying to make it, but then she ends up just sleeping with someone because she gets herself into a situation, but eventually she does make it. And then of course, you know, it's the whole, I'm too good for all my friends now. And, you know, there's a full on, like walking down the staircase, like Sunset Boulevard scene. And eventually she ends up losing everything and, yada, yada, yada. But, I don't know. I mean, this isn't a very good movie, but it was pretty fun to watch. And watching Juanita Brown just fucking yell at everyone and then cry was pretty awesome. And I don't think I'd go out of my way trying to seek this out, but it's definitely a pretty interesting rarity.
Well, yeah, it's always nice to like know there's a subgenre out there like blaxploitation where you're like, you feel like you're starting to see it all, and then these movies pop up out of nowhere and you're like, oh, didn't know about that one.
Yeah.
And because there was just so many of them, right? Like, there was way more of them than you actually think until you start diving into it. And then when you find one like this, you're like, okay, I might not have liked it that much, but I'm glad I got to see it.
Yeah, and watching shit like this really does make me miss the days of going through the previously viewed shit at the video store. I mean, I used to love that, and you would find such cool stuff.
Yeah,
when you did that, and you could, and back when we were growing up, you could drive around for a day and go to like 20 video stores and find some real treasures. And now it's very, very difficult.
Yeah, we used to do that.
You
all the time.
You don't find this shit at Value Village anymore, right? Mm-mm. Unless it's the Value Village I've been dropping shit off at. But I mean, it's very hard now because it's all on eBay, right? And it was just a different time. And I'm really glad that, I know at the time I was like questioning my sanity by buying so many movies, but really glad I did now, because, you know, I'm finding some of these things. But,
well, because some of this stuff might never pass through anything higher than VHS.
It's true. Like, I mean, I'm trying to unload some of this stuff, so I am going to be putting this one on eBay. But it is kind of like, man, once I let this go, I'll probably never see it again. Like, unless I buy a copy off eBay. But I'll never run across one of these in the store where you, back in the day, you would find like 10 of these in a weekend, right? It's like movies like this. So anyway, kind of cool. Glad I saw it. Don't think I need to see it again.
Josh's VHS Adventures!
All right. Get to the topic.
Let's
get to bed.
We just wrapped up our, what have we been watching?
We're way later than normal, by the way, like recording. We're like 2 hours behind schedule.
Yeah, so we'll do what we can. So anyway, we wanted to do you know, another monster episode about a form of monster, because we've done it in the past. And we decided that with the first of the Dark Universal movies coming out this past Friday with Tom Cruise's The Mummy, that mummies would be a pretty good one to hit on.
Mm-hmm.
So more on that later. So I was just wondering, Josh, like, what was your real first exposure to, like, mummies in general? Because I can tell you exactly what mine is. Like, I'm not talking just, like, mummies in the sense of, like, filmatic mummies. I'm just talking mummies. Like, when did you become aware that there was this, like, kind of thing that went on, like, mummification and everything? Like, can you kind of point at what it was that made you aware of this? Or should
I was really into, like, educational books when I was a kid. Right. So it was probably reading some, like, book about ancient Egypt and reading about pyramids and then being like, whoa, they embalm these fuckers and then wrap them up. That's
like,
wild.
Like, I can totally point to you, like, the first exposure I remember was obviously Tutankhamun.
Yeah.
So King Tut. So what this was this was basically it was a 10-year-old boy who was Egyptian royalty, who his tomb was found in like the 20s, 1922 actually. And in the 70s, from 1972 to like 1979, all the artifacts from his tomb and even his, I think his sarcophagus even, went on a museum tour worldwide. And there was such a fervor for this. Like, I remember everyone being so excited that this, all this Egyptian stuff from King Tut was being toured around. And, you know, it was like a big deal. Like, this was a big thing. Like, even Steve Martin did a novelty song called King Tut on Saturday Night Live and everything. Like, King Tut was a big deal. So that's like where I first remember hearing about mummies and what mummies were and things like that, right? And obviously King Tut doesn't represent what we think of in film form. So once I learned about King Tut and that, I did the same thing as you. I dived into some of these encyclopedias and stuff and learned about ancient Egypt and mummification. And I was like, they really did that to people? You know,
they
things
pull
like
their
that.
Brains out of their nose with a hook?
Yeah,
weird.
Like, you're like, whoa, this is crazy stuff, right? And it's then that we started watching these mummy movies. So
yeah,
I think the logical place to start with this would be with Universal Monsters and the mummy movies. So what I'm going to do is we'll touch on the three tiers of Universal Mummy Monsters, because there are now three tiers. The first tier is obviously the golden era, the classic era of Universal Monsters. We're talking, you know, Boris Karloff, the mummy in 1932, and then the five sequels, you know. So like, I haven't seen these films in a little while, and the reason for that is, for the Universal Monsters, I've never really put the mummy as high as, say, Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman. I've put him above the Invisible Man.
Yeah.
But for me, mummies, like, there was more mummy movies out there than I actually thought there was when I started looking into this topic. But at the same time, I'm like, they really don't make a lot of these movies. And I feel like when they do make them, a lot of them are more like blockbuster type movies, to be honest. Like, it's weird that way.
Yeah.
Like, you're not seeing a lot of low budget mummy movies, like, nowadays at all. You're still, like, Dracula movies and stuff, like vampire movies, tons. But I don't know if that's just because filmmakers don't want to try and make their movies Egyptian looking and failing at it, or what the deal is. But I just find mummies to be, like, you think zombies are slow, mummies are a little bit more shambling, and that never really did anything for me particularly.
Well, I think part of the thing too is you can't really give a mummy a personality.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like
all they do is just go,
everyone's trying to give personalities and backstory and all that. I mean, I think it started with when Coppola did his Dracula and Branagh did the Frankenstein. Like, you know, we really started getting into this, oh, we've got to give them a backstory and personality. And a mummy's just a dude in a bandages, man. Like, he's a monster.
Well, and if you go by Egyptian lore, he's a monster wrapped in bandages. And he's not a smart monster because his brains have been pulled out with a fucking hook.
Yeah, exactly.
So really, a mummy is a non-personality, undead shell.
So that's the thing. I think when you're trying to make all these movies with all these personalities and stuff, you can't really do that with a mummy. I mean, of course, now back to Universal, the original Karloff movie.
I think that's the one that set up the look of mummies, as usual.
Right, but I mean, the Jack Pierce makeup job that he did on Boris Karloff was only in the first, like, 5-10 minutes maybe of the movie.
Yeah.
And then you don't see that creature that we know of. Like, when I think of the mummy, I'm thinking of Karloff in the first 5 or 10 minutes of the mummy.
Right.
But that creature is only there for that period. The rest of the movie is Karloff looking like Karloff with a little bit of, like, aging on his face.
Right. And
but
wearing,
he's a,
like,
human walking around with a hat on and shit. Yeah. Like, there's no bandages. So, you know, but that monster is what I think of.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, too, in a lot of these movies we're going to mention, it's exactly like that, though, because a lot of them do try and put in a little bit of backstory, and the mummy is kind of secondary a lot of times to what's actually the plot of the movie, and which is weird when it's supposed to be a monster movie that you're throwing your creature into the background a little bit, and we'll see that as we go along, right? Like, this happens a lot in these movies, and I'm not sure if that's because it's hard to give a mummy personality.
Yeah,
I mean, that might be the case, or maybe the filmmakers just feel like the Egyptian backstory is more interesting to an audience. I'm like, no, I don't need an Egyptian backstory particularly. I just want a guy wrapped in bandages ripping people's faces off.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of it's a love story too, and you know, that's what happened in the first, and again, in the Karloff one. Like, we get past the monster stuff, then it turns into this love story sort of where, you know, Karloff's character Imhotep is now, you know, trying to, like, find his lost love that he believes has been reincarnated in the actress Zita Johann, and it's more of like a kind of a tragic love story than a monster movie.
Well, that's what I feel like the sequels were a bit more monstery.
They
than
were
this
and,
one,
and
yeah.
like, but I mean, I think a lot of that, like, this has been a bit of a problem in some of the other mummy movies as well, is what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to mention the five sequels right now.
Four sequels.
Technically five if we're counting a certain one that I'm going to talk about at the end. There's The Mummy's Hand, The Mummy's Tomb, The Mummy's Ghost, The Mummy's Curse, and Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy.
I don't know if I count the Abbott and Costello.
Yeah,
I guess.
So what... I don't really have a lot to say about these movies because I haven't seen them in a while. They were basically made in a stretch from, I think it's 1944 to 1946 for the sequels.
49.
Lon Chaney Jr. actually played the mummy in Tomb, Ghost, and Curse.
44, sorry, yeah.
Yeah. Tomb, Ghost, and Curse. The Mummy's Tomb, Ghost, and Curse were Lon Chaney Jr., which I thought was pretty cool that... He took the mantle from Boris Karloff and the actor before him because he also played other Universal monsters. So, I mean, I liked that, but these movies for me, I haven't seen them in a long time. I don't really remember tons about them, to be honest with you. And I just remember them being like kind of a little bit more leisurely paced than I like from my Universal monster movies.
Right, but they're all really short.
Yeah, they're only like 60, 65 minutes, 70 minutes, something like that. I also feel like even the Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy movie, it's like when you're trying to compare the Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, you just can't do it. It just doesn't compare.
No, it's true.
So, I mean, that's the first kind of golden phase of Universal.
Well,
mummy
the interesting
movies.
Thing about them, too, is I found it odd how they took the Karloff one and then completely kind of abandoned that whole storyline. So the other ones did not contain Imhotep.
Right.
They were a completely separate storyline. So they were like using a mummy, but they were not in any way related to the original story. And then those next four, they were all related with each other. With a different character named Karis. Instead of Imhotep. And we'll see, like, throughout when we're talking about other movies, some of them have Karis and some of them have Imhotep, which I think is interesting. Like, and I guess that's maybe people talk, showing what their influences are, depending on which mummy they decide to call their mummy in later films.
Right. I've always considered Imhotep to be the essential mummy name, though, personally.
That's what I think, too. But then yeah. Yeah, those four sequels all had Karras, as I think as did the Abner Costello one. So.
Okay. So that's the Golden Age. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you have any more to add on that. I mean, I haven't seen these movies in a while, like I said, so I don't have tons more to add to that.
Yeah, no, not really.
Because it's like I said, I've always been more towards, even Creature from the Black Lagoon, I've always liked more than The Mummy, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing that really strikes me about those ones is I know Mummy's Curse. I know my dad used to talk about that one as being the movie that scared him the most when he was a kid. So, I do think of that one a bit special. That in that way, he talks about the scene with construction vehicles and stuff, where a mummy's hand comes up and says he terrified him. And
yeah,
I think that's kind of cool. So
I actually just bought the Legacy Collection, and I'm just waiting for it to show up so I can kind of revisit all six of these.
Oh, they're short. You can watch them in the afternoon.
Yeah, I just want to check them out because I feel like the Universal Monsters, I'm probably the least educated and familiar with these ones. So yeah. I want to give them another go. So after that, the Universal Monsters kind of were like sparingly used, but I think the next big reboot, I guess you would call it, came in 1999 when they relaunched it with the Mummy, Brendan Fraser starring Mummy series.
Yeah.
Now, this first one, it was super successful. I remember seeing it in the theater. It was kind of like mixing an Indiana Jones movie with a Mummy movie because Brendan Fraser played like the title fedora wearing type hero who took on this ancient Egyptian mummy played by Arnold Vosloo, who I actually thought was pretty good in this movie.
Yeah.
As the mummy, he's a guy who has been a lot of like direct-to-video stuff. The most memorably, he took over as Darkman in both of the Darkman sequels.
Yeah.
And it was directed by Stephen Sommers. Now, yes. This is before Stephen Sommers became kind of a punchline in the sense that the guy went on to make some really bad movies with bad CG and just bad plots.
Yeah.
Like he made Deep Rising before this, which I think is actually kind of a fun aquatic sea creature movie. And he did do the first sequel to this, The Mummy Returns, but he also directed Van Helsing.
Yeah.
Which is a very unsuccessful attempt by Universal to bring a lot of the Universal monsters into like kind of an action movie with Hugh Jackman. It's a pretty terrible movie.
You think they would have learned.
Yeah. You think so. And he also did the G.I. Joe, one of the G.I. Joe movies.
Oh, okay.
In recent years. So he's kind of become a punchline. But I enjoy the first Mummy movie for what it is. It tries to be Indiana Jones, but it does bring in enough of the Egyptian mythos to work. It's got the scarabs in it and things like that. Just stuff you remember from reading about mummies. And I thought the first movie was kind of fun. It's got that memorable scene with like where the mummy takes the form of a sandstorm.
Yeah.
And tries to swallow their biplane.
Right.
And it makes a face shape. I thought that scene was pretty cool. Even The Mummy Returns was pretty good, even though the CG was way more obvious in the sequel, I found.
That scene at the end of The Mummy Returns stands out to me as one of the worst.
The Scorpion King stuff?
One of the worst terrible. CG scenes.
That is terrible. Ever. That's basically where they tried to get Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, to be the Scorpion King, and they completely CG'd him as a monster at the end, and it just looks so bad.
It looks so bad.
Like, it looks terrible. Which is funny because they spun that off, the Scorpion King, into his own movie, which has had three direct-to-DVD sequels. Four?
Yeah.
There's a fourth one coming?
Hold on. I didn't write down how many. I think there's four or five total.
Yeah, and they're just like basically Conan in Egypt in a way because the title character is just like a Conan-type character. There's no mummies involved in those movies, I don't believe at all.
Well, just on a side note with that, though, I gotta say I'm gonna check out that series.
Really?
Well, Chuck Russell directed the first one.
Yep.
And then it's like, here's some of the people that are in them: Billy Zane,
yep,
Ron Perlman, Dave Bautista, Randy Couture,
yep,
Lou Ferrigno, and Rutger Hauer. They all appear in at least one of the Scorpion.
So you're like, I might have to watch these.
I'm totally going to watch them.
And I know that I haven't seen it, but I know they tried to take the series in a new direction when Summers left, when they made the third one, which was Curse of the Dragon's Tomb, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Where they transplanted it to China and brought in Jet Li.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really got to say, I think it's a huge mistake when you try and bring Jet Li into American movies just to give it that Asian flavor.
Yeah.
It didn't work in Lethal Weapon 4. It didn't work. I'm assuming it doesn't work with the third Mummy movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Like, I don't really like Jet Li's American output that much, to be honest, because I don't think he really belongs in a lot of those movies. I think he's just thrown in there as, like, the token martial artist.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. I haven't seen the third one, but
Michelle Yeoh's in it as well.
I don't have high hopes for that one, and that's why I never watched it.
Yeah.
So anything more to add on those ones?
Nope.
So let's move on.
Sounds like you liked them a lot more than I did.
Yeah, I liked the first one. I don't care about Scorpion King or Mummy Returns particularly. So now we talked about Dark Universal.
Yeah.
So take it away, Josh, because you've had the opportunity to sample some Dark Universal.
Fuck me. I was really hoping I'd be drunker by the time we got to this, but fuck off. Like, seriously, I went to see this piece of shit in the theaters. And so this is The Mummy 2017. It's directed by Alex Kurtzman. I was already a little concerned. Now, he's got a bit of a horror background. He created Fringe, and he created Sleepy Hollow, the TV series. And he also wrote the Star Trek reboots. And he's been a writer and done other things. So he does have a bit of a genre background, but I just felt a little uneasy. And then I felt more uneasy with the Dark Universe when they announced that they were going to be doing they were going to be bringing back the classic monsters as action movies, not horror movies. And they really seemed to want to distance themselves from horror, which concerned me a lot as well.
Right.
So
didn't work with Van Helsing, so let's do it again.
So the movie opens in Iraq, I think Iraq.
Somewhere like that, yeah.
And it opens with a big fucking action scene.
Yeah.
And
I think that action scene was in the first trailer.
And it's like them being shot at by insurgents. Is that the one you're thinking of?
No, there's one in a plane I'm thinking of.
Okay, yeah. So they're being shot at by insurgents, and Tom Cruise is running around. Okay, we've got a fucking comic relief best friend played by Jake Johnson. Oh my god. Like, so again, like, I'm just like losing my shit here because I can't stand this stuff, and I can't stand like comic relief characters, but people love this shit. And reading reviews, they've all been like, oh, Jake Johnson stole the show, he's so funny. Like, so, you know, the whole time here we're missing the point. Like, we're missing the point of what Dark Universe is supposed to be. We're missing the point of what horror fans were excited about, and that's that we're going to be bringing back our classic beloved characters into the new age. But no, they're not doing that at all. Like, this was the fucking worst horror action movie I've seen in recent memory. Like, this was so fucking bad. Okay, first, my first thought, because honestly, we didn't know what to go see. I went with my buddy. We didn't really know what we were going to go see. We were going to go see Baywatch because that's how fucking bottom of the barrel we were going. And then I saw this was playing a day early, so we decided to go to this. One of the main things I thought throughout the movie was, fuck, I should have gone to Baywatch, which is
that's a sad brutal thought.
Yeah. Secondly, like, honestly, I hated this so much, I wanted to stand up repeatedly throughout the movie. I wanted to stand up and just fucking give the screen, like, double fingers. Like, but I knew that wouldn't really accomplish anything. No. And I just have some jackass behind me telling me to sit down. The other thing is, I think I actually liked Ghostbusters more than this.
Wow.
Yeah, this was a fucking disaster. And everything about it made me not want to see anything else in the Dark Universe. So introduced in this is Russell Crowe playing Dr. Jekyll. Fuck no, I don't want to see anything else with him in it. He was just I mean, Russell Crowe, like back in Romper Stomper, even Virtuosity days, I thought he was a really cool actor.
Good guys.
Hmm?
Good guys.
Nice guys.
Nice guys.
So he's good in that. But yeah. But this Russell Crowe, and he's done it in some other things recently where I'm just like, what are you doing? And it was just painful. And I can't even imagine watching a whole feature with this character. So, and that's supposedly coming. And I like, yeah, just there's a love interest for Tom Cruise named Anna, named Jenny, played by Annabelle Wallace. She hasn't really done a lot other than she was in Annabelle, that horror movie. But she's this like blonde, like our other archaeologist, beautiful, of course. But again, like all of a sudden, Tom Cruise is like into her enough to like risk his life after knowing her for like 20 minutes. Like I just, all this type of lazy bullshit writing, I just don't understand. Plus the mummy herself is like a female version. And honestly, like I thought I was going to get really riled up about this. And I just give so little of a shit about this movie. Hands down, this is going to be the worst movie of the year. There's no question. It's killed my desire to see anything else in Dark Universe. Honestly, I don't think I'll be seeing anything else. I mean, from what I understand is coming now, if it even happens, because this thing tanked. We've got fucking Johnny Depp, who I can't stand, playing the Invisible Man, possibly. We've got Javier Bardem playing...
Wolfman.
Is it the Wolfman?
I think it might be the Wolfman, isn't it?
No, he's playing Frankenstein.
Oh, okay.
But again, like, I thought he used to be a really cool actor, but after, you know, being with his buddy Johnny and the shit show that was the last Pirates of the Caribbean movie, I don't know if I care about him anymore. Wolfman, they're talking The Rock.
Oh, God.
Dwayne Johnson. Like, I'm just not excited about this at all, and I think it's a real shame. I think Universal could have really done horror fans a solid. And considering the fact that horror movies are what kind of put Universal on the map back in the day in the first place, I really think they could have given a little more respect to the people that care about this type of stuff. Because I, for one, don't anymore. I am not excited in any way whatsoever about the Stark universe. And I think it's a real shame. And if this movie's any indication of what's coming, it's a complete disaster. And I have no interest. This was one of the worst, most poorly written movies I've seen in a long time. Lazy. I didn't care about anyone. I didn't care about anything. That one action scene on the airplane was kind of cool. Other than that, like the whole climax, I thought was just ridiculous. The villain was stupid. Like everything about it was just awful. So, and it's also setting up Tom Cruise to be in future movies along with the Jackass sidekick. So if that's what I've got to look forward to, I'm out. So it's really too bad. But I was going to rage on this. I was going to try and really rant about it, but I just don't have the fucking energy. It's really kind of bummed me out. I'm just bummed out. So that's my review on the new Mummy.
Right.
But they've really, I think Universal's really kind of, yeah, it's kind of like a fuck you to horror fans. Like, why would you make a horror movie and like, kind of say, and not want to call it, like, they've been really, really making a point of, like, marketing executives and stuff, of distancing themselves from the genre, which I think is crazy. People are still saying they're scared by this shit. Fuck that.
All right. Anyway. So, that's the Universal aspect of the Mummy.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about the couple of studios or areas where they tried to cash in on the success of these Universal Mummy movies, be it years later. I'm going to start with just the really bizarre Mexican aspect of the Mummy movies.
Right.
And we're talking the Aztec Mummy movies.
Right.
Now, I have not seen these movies, but I've seen enough clips to know that I want to see these movies. These are movies that were filmed in 1957 and 1958, there was three of them. And the Aztec Mummy, The Curse of the Aztec Mummy, and The Robot versus the Aztec Mummy, which looks pretty epic.
Right.
They were all directed by a guy called Rafael Portillo. They're black and white, really low budget Mexican shot films. The mummy is kind of, especially in the robot versus the Aztec mummy, it's not wrapped in bandages. It just looks like a deformed kind of monster. And the robot's just this ridiculous Mexican guy in a metal suit. And there's a fight scene in it that's pretty epic, worth talking about. And these are movies that have been parodied on like Mystery Science Theater and things like that. But you have to remember, like, this is South America, Mexico. The Mexican film industry wasn't really a big thing in the 50s. And the fact that they made these movies, which you could tell they were kind of making because of, they're like, oh, the mummy movies were popular at one time in America. Let's try and cash in on this. Makes them worth mentioning, at least.
Yeah.
The one that's really worth mentioning that's not part of that series but is also a Mexican movie is a 1964 film called Wrestling Woman versus the Aztec Mummy. And that's like luchadors versus mummies,
yeah,
which makes it instantly worth seeing. It's directed by Rene Cardona, who did Night of the Bloody Apes.
Yeah.
His son, Rene Cardona Jr., made a couple of really memorable, because they're bad, horror movies in the 70s and 80s called Tintora, The Killer Shark, and Beaks, the Movie.
Yeah, he was also did a lot of, like, really exploitative versions of, like, real life stories. Like, he did, like, one called Survive, which was based on the, like, Alive story.
Well, that was Rene Cardona Jr. Sr. who did.
And then there was Survive. Also... there was also the one, whatever.
Whatever it's called. But, I mean, that's another one where it's kind of like they tried
to... The Jim Jones one is what I was going to say.
Oh, the Guyana...
Yeah, yeah.
Days of Terror, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
So, Cult of Terror, I think it's called. Guyana Cult of Terror. But the thing is about these is, like, they were just trying to put their own spin on the mummy legend. And it really... might not have worked because they tried to do the Aztec spin because, you know, there's a lot of Aztec history down in Mexico. And I haven't seen the Aztec Mummy movies, but I have seen the Wrestling Women versus the Aztec Mummy. And it's a pretty fun, low budget movie. Keep your expectations low, right?
Yeah.
So there's that aspect. And then of course there is the mummy movie that I think is done right. And that's when Hammer did 1959's The Mummy with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. And I really do love that movie.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I think that's a really good one. They also did a series after they did The Mummy, which has Christopher Lee playing the main mummy in it, which, you know, how can you not cast Christopher Lee in that role if you're a Hammer film?
Yeah.
Guy played Dracula. I mean, he's pretty iconic in these roles. There was other sequels in it, but I think the most notable one is a movie from 1971 called Blood from the Mummies 2. The reason I say this is because it had a female mummy, yeah, played by Valerie Leone, who is really super hot in this movie, admittedly. She's possessed by an Egyptian ring that her dad gives her.
Yeah.
And it used to be, and she has to do the bidding of an Egyptian queen. Like a resurrected Egyptian queen.
Right.
This is based on a story by Bram Stoker called Legend of the Seven Jewels, I believe it is.
Yep.
And the story will pop up later because there's other movies we're going to mention that is based on that story. And, you know, she never wears wraps in this movie, but she does wear some skimpy clothes and has a severed hand. So I just find that when Universal did... they're monsters. Hammer would go and do their own version of them, but theirs were always a bit more lurid. They were always in color. They had a little bit more bloodshed, and they always had Cushing and Lee. And you know, I haven't seen all the Hammer movies, but I really do enjoy some of their monster movies. Like, I really love The Mummy from 1959. I've liked some of their Dracula movies and stuff, but I feel like after the Karloff Mummy, I think that the Hammer one from 59 is probably the essential mummy movie that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, it didn't make that much of an impression on me, but that's good. That, I mean, obviously it is iconic, but yeah, it didn't have the same impression for me, that's for sure.
Well, I think it's iconic in the sense that, you know, even the poster for that one was iconic because it was a hand-drawn poster and it had the mummy towering over everybody and he had the wraps, but they were like kind of falling off and he had the glowing yellow eyes. And yeah. I just think that's a really cool image
it
that
is.
They used.
Yeah.
And I just find that to be a more entertaining movie than most of these mummy movies, and I really dig that one.
Good. That's good. I think I need to revisit it maybe.
Okay, so anything to add on that?
Not really. I mean, the first Hammer one was directed by Terrence Fisher, who was known for doing, well, he's done a lot of the iconic Hammer movies, notably Horror of Dracula, and I think he did the first werewolf one as well. The first Frankenstein one. This also follows the exact same plot of three of the Karloff, or of the
Universal sequels.
Post-Karloff ones, the Hand, Tomb, and Ghost of the Mummy. I don't have much more to say about any of those.
Okay, so now what I was going to do is I was just going to mention, I kind of have now like a laundry list of mummy movies where I didn't really have any kind of theme going for it. It was just ones that I wrote down that I thought were notable in this kind of monster subgenre. So I'm just going to, we'll just kind of go back and forth on those if you want to do that.
Okay.
Ones we wrote down. Some of these I wrote down are not considered to be mummy movies, but they have a mummy in them that I thought it was notable to mention.
Okay.
So one of the first ones I wrote down is a movie that I have not seen, but I've heard so much about and need to track down. It's a 1981 movie called Dawn of the Mummy.
Yeah.
And the reason I wrote this down is because it's an actual mummy movie made in Egypt.
Right.
So it's funded by an Egyptian company, made by an Egyptian director. The director's name is Frank R. Agrama. Why this is notable is because it's not like your stereotypical mummy movie, in the sense that every time I've seen anyone describing this movie, they say it's like a Romero zombie movie meets mummies, because they do a lot of gut eating in this movie and stuff like that. I've heard it's a very gory movie. I've heard it's not exactly the most well-made movie or well-acted movie, but I've heard it's worth seeing at least once. I remember the old video box that was put out by Thorn Emmy in those white clamshells back in the day, that which was a cartoon of a mummy busting out of a grave, which was really cool.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Frank Agrama ripped off King Kong when he made a movie called Queen Kong also. Yeah. And when I was looking into him, I found it interesting that he was part of this really elaborate tax fraud and embezzlement charges film rights. So if you're interested in that, look that up online. There, it's a pretty fascinating story behind that. And another notable thing is that the star of this movie, Brenda King, who wasn't in very many movies, was actually married to Roy Scheider.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I want to check this one out. Unfortunately, the DVD, which is just like a full frame VHS transfer, is out of print.
Oh, okay.
So we'll see if I can hunt it down for fairly cheap, but it's one I've always been interested in.
Nice.
And I will keep going if you'd like.
No, the first one I thought of when we talked about this topic was The Awakening from 1980.
Yeah, I wrote that down.
I was a huge Charlton Heston fan back in the day. This one was directed by Mike Newell, also based on the Bram Stoker story, Jewel of the Seven Stars.
Seven Stars, yeah.
Yeah. Mike Newell also has done like Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire and Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Donnie Brasco.
What's that?
Donnie Brasco,
yeah. So this stars Charlton Heston as like an archaeologist who's looking into mummies or looking into Egyptian stuff. And he ends up bringing it, I think, a mummy back to the States or to Europe. I can't remember where he goes. Anyway, he's got a daughter now. He was basically cheating on his wife when he first found the mummy, and now has ended up with his assistant, played by Susanna York, who's Superman's mom in the first Superman movie.
Yeah, she also won an Oscar for They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Oh, yeah, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
And his daughter's played by Stephanie Zimbalist. And then it's pretty much the story of
the daughter gets possessed.
Possession, yeah.
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 She gets possessed, and then Charlton Heston has to try and get her unpossessed and destroy the evil mummy. And, you know, I haven't seen the movie, but when I watched the trailer, I assume there's a lot of supernatural kind of stuff going on in the film and all that kind of stuff. I'm intrigued by this one, admittedly.
Yeah, it's all right. I mean, I thought it was a little boring. You know, honestly, like, just my take on this whole genre, frankly. I know I've been a little like meh, meh, meh about some of them, but honestly, I think most of the movies in this genre are fucking boring. And this is...
We're selling it.
This is no exception. No, I'm sorry. They are. They're boring to me. And mummies in general are boring. And this is no exception.
It's like I said, because they're just... They shuffle slower than zombies. They have no personality. I can see where you're coming from.
Well, in a lot of them, there's just not... Like, there's just not a mummy really walking around. Like, from this movie, from what I remember, there just isn't much, if any, mummy action in this.
Right.
Even though it's kind of sold as a mummy movie, but it's more of a, like, kind of a curse possession type movie, which I find a lot of these are.
The only other things I wanted to mention about that movie is that Stephanie Zimbalist, who plays the daughter, this was really only her second movie role. She was in The Magic of Lassie before this and a bunch of TV shows. But if you're wondering who she is, she's most notable as being the sidekick to Pierce Brosnan on Remington Steele back in the day. And the story, the Bram Stoker novel, Jewel of the Seven Stars, was filmed again in 1988 for this really awful movie called Tale of the Mummy, starring Lou Gossett Jr., that was directed by Jeffrey Obrow, who made The Kindred and Dorm That Dripped Blood. It's an awful movie. I don't recommend you look for it, but I just found it was interesting that they used the Stoker story for inspiration for a bunch of these movies that we're talking about.
Also loosely in Fertile and Raised the Tomb.
Oh, okay.
From
86.
86 also uses the same story again.
Okay. So the next one I want to talk about this one's actually is a straightforward, I'm not mummy movie, but like it's kind of like a crazy over the top mummy movie. It's from 1998. It's called Tale of the Mummy, also known as Talos the Mummy. Now, I remember seeing this movie in Fangoria back in the day and thinking it looked really cool. And then it just was one of those movies that got delayed for like a couple years because it was a Miramax Dimension kind of movie and it took forever to come out.
Yeah.
It's directed by Russell Mulcahy.
Yeah.
He's an Australian director who was known mostly for music videos. He did like all those cool Duran Duran ones you remember, like Hungry Like the Wolf and Rio and stuff.
Night Boat.
He also made this really cool Australian horror movie called Razorback.
Yeah.
About a farmer versus this giant killer boar that I think is really cool.
He also did the video for Video Killed the Radio Star.
Oh, he did?
The first music video ever aired on MTV.
Directed Highlander, the original Highlander movie. Directed Ricochet with John Lithgow and Denzel Washington, which I think is a really fun flick. And he made sequels to Resident Evil and Scorpion King.
Oh, there you go.
So, Talos the Mummy is just your typical, like, it's... You know, it's got a pretty, pretty cool cast. It's got Jason Scott Lee's the main actor. He was in The Dragon, the Bruce Lee story. Yeah. Sean Pertwee's in this. Lizette Anthony's in this. Shelley Duvall from The Shining is in this. Gerard Butler before 300 when he was doing the Dracula 2000 movie and that for Dimension was in this. And Christopher Lee is in this.
And Pussy Galore is in this too.
Oh, yeah?
Honor Black Men, yeah.
Oh, okay. And I remember liking this when I originally saw it on DVD, but I watched a trailer before when I was writing about it. And I'm like, this movie does not look good.
Yeah.
Because what this basically is it's like a CG mummy fest. So it's like they bring this mummy back from Egypt. And then what happens is I feel like it has mummy moments, but a lot of it is just the bandages flying through the air and CG and attacking people.
Oh, awesome.
Like wrapping around them and like attacking them and stuff like that. Like, and I'm just like, I don't know if I'm curious to rewatch this one now, but I remember like I thought it was cool back in the day, but you know, hindsight's always 20/20, I guess. And we'll see what happens if I ever do get around to it. But I just thought it was worth mentioning because it was like one of those more modern day mummy movies that kind of came out of nowhere and, you know, didn't really do much, but worth talking about because of the cast and the director and the fact that it was Dimension Films trying to do a mummy movie.
Yeah, I'm definitely curious to check this one out just based on the cast alone and Russell Mulcahy. I've always liked what he's done. So,
well, apart from that Resident Evil sequel.
And apart from Highlander. But
hey, I like Highlander. Well,
sorry. I know.
Well, he did Highlander 2, The Quickening, if that makes it any... if that balances it out for you.
Okay. Yeah. All right, I watched The Pyramid.
Okay.
So The Pyramid is fairly recent. Sort of a... Okay. So it's a movie about a group that go into a pyramid in Egypt. They find another pyramid by the other great pyramids that's underground. And they're sort of told that they have to leave Egypt, but they decide, oh no, we're going to just go and explore it really quick before we have to leave. And of course, shit happens and they get trapped in the pyramid. This is what that fucking Tom Cruise movie should have been, I think. Now, this was not a great movie. So first of all, this is quote unquote found footage, but it's, I don't really want to say poorly done found footage. I'd like to more say that this is a interesting mix of found footage and traditional filmmaking. So I don't know if I'm being too polite by saying that, because what you've got is found footage happening, but then there'll be an overhead shot. So it's not really found footage when you're having when all of a sudden the camera's above all the characters and you're seeing all the characters on the screen. So there's a lot of like found footage stuff, but then there's a lot of quote unquote cheat shots happening where,
right,
no one's clearly,
a lot of the modern ones are doing that now though.
So I didn't mind it once I sort of got past that. Like once I was like, okay, well, I guess this isn't really a found footage movie, but whatever. They're using found footage, whatever. I just wish they didn't sort of sell it as, you know, the beginning is like, this is the footage that was found. So anyway, I don't like being too nitpicky about that stuff. But this is kind of like what I always expect when I go to see a movie like this, is I want to see them going into a pyramid. I want to see fucking monsters, if possible, like The Descent. This did remind me a bit of The Descent, just because they're like kind of trapped in confined spaces and there's creatures around. I also like to see in these types of movies like hidden rooms and booby traps, and this had tons of that stuff. Plus, I didn't mind the cast of this. I liked them. So I really liked this movie up until a certain point. It then got into like super shitty. I don't know why they keep doing this. All they had to do in this movie was just build a fucking, like have a guy in a suit and running around, and it would have been great. But no, they had to go with like the full CG character, of like a monster. And like, it just kind of, it was so obviously CG. It was just, kind of shitty that way, but again, I was trying to just play into the whole B movie aspect of it, and I did quite enjoy this. But I just really wish that some of these movies would have done that. And I really wish the Cruise movie had gone down this road. I wish they had traded scripts, to be honest. So I like this quite a bit. Again, this is on Netflix right now if you want to check it out.
Okay. The next one I want to talk about before I dive into my actual ones, where I'm just going to quickly mention them, is 2003's Bubba Hotep is a mummy movie.
Yeah.
So this is a total cult movie directed by Don Coscarelli, who made Phantasm and The Beastmaster, and John dies at the end. And it stars Bruce Campbell playing Elvis Presley, put into a nursing home. He meets up with Ozzie Davis, who's playing JFK, even though he's a black man in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And basically they are tasked to take on a cowboy mummy in their nursing home.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a movie where I can understand the appeal, but at the same time, I don't understand the appeal. Because I don't remember loving this movie when I saw it. Like, it's based on a Joe R. Lansdale story, and I love Joe R. Lansdale books.
Yeah.
But I just never really got it.
Yeah.
Like, it's the same thing with Coscarelli's John Dies at the End. I love the book that's based on by David Wong, but the movie didn't do it for me, but it's got a cult following and I don't get it.
Yeah.
This movie is a fun movie in the sense that it's good to see Campbell and Davis's interplay with each other. I think Bruce is really funny in this because he's playing Elvis.
Yeah.
I think there's some good scenes. Like there's a scene where he battles a scarab that's pretty fun. And I think that making the mummy into like this, like, deranged cowboy type mummy is pretty amusing too.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth seeing if you're into cult movies, but I don't understand why it's so appealing to some people. like, it just came out collector's edition from Scream Factory.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's fun for what it is, but I remember that I liked the mummy in this because it was different.
Yeah.
Like, it was a mummy in a cowboy hat. He was kind of like, I remember scenes of him being backlit coming down the hallway towards him and things like that. And it was pretty good. It was a pretty good low flick.
Really?
Yeah, pretty good. Not
you
like
changed your tune.
No, I'm saying I don't understand why it's got such a cult following, yeah. But I still think it's pretty good.
It's just watch it when you're awake. That's all I have to say about that.
Seems to be a trend with you falling asleep when you're watching stuff.
I'm tired these days, and I'm fucking tired right now.
We're almost done.
What's that? Yeah, I know. There's another one called Sphinx.
Yep.
There's no mummy in Sphinx.
Seems to be a trend in some of these.
Yeah. It sold, again, like, I remember when I bought the VHS for this, I was thinking this was going to be like a mummy, Egyptian, cursey type movie. No. It's Leslie Ann Down and Frank Langella looking really bored, fighting like black marketers in the Valley of the Kings. Yawn.
Sounds really exciting.
Moving on.
Moving on. So I'm just gonna hammer out the last of mine because they're just movies that contain a mummy but aren't mummy movies particularly. Obviously, I couldn't talk about mummies without talking about The Monster Squad from 87. Right. Fred Decker's film, which has a cult following also. It's basically kids fighting monsters led by Dracula. The mummy is part of his team. It's worth mentioning because Shane Black co-wrote it.
Right.
There is a funny scene involving the mummy where the kid's freaking out that there's a monster in his closet. And the dad's like, there's nothing in the closet. What are you talking about? And he opens the closet and is standing there holding the door open and looking at the kid saying, see, there's nothing in there. And the mummy's in there like kind of like, that's a pretty fun scene. But this is another movie like Bubba Hotep that has like a total cult following. And even though I think it's a pretty good movie, I don't quite understand why it's got such rabid fans. Another one I want to talk about quickly is Tales from the Dark Side, the movie from 1990. There's a segment in it called Lot 249, which has a bunch of college students led by Christian Slater and Steve Buscemi finding a crate that contains a mummy. Mummy comes back, wreaks havoc on the college campus. Julianne Moore also appears in this. The reason I appreciate this mummy movie is that he looks like the kind of mummy I'd want because he's all dusty and gross looking. And he does pull someone's brain out using a metal hook in the segment, which I think is awesome. Then we have The Creeps from 1997, which is a ridiculous Charles Band movie, which is like The Monster Squad in the sense that it's Dracula leading a bunch of other monsters to harass human beings. The twist on this is that they're all pint sized, so it's all little people playing the monsters. Dracula is played by Phil Fondacaro, who Charles Band loves and puts in all his movies when he needs a little person. He was in Ghoulies 2. He was in, you know, The Dungeon Master and all these kind of movies. And the last one I want to talk about real quick is Mad Monster Party from 64 by Rankin Bass, who made all those classic stop motion Christmas specials you love, like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and stuff. This is just like a movie that's basically Baron Frankenstein having a party at his house, and the mummy's one of the guests. So those are the ones I wrote down that I just want to mention that have mummies in them that I think are worth checking out because they're pretty decent flicks.
Okay. There's also a loose kind of remake of Dawn of the Mummy.
Okay.
That hasn't really come out. It's sort of come out, sort of been released, but I don't think it ever got a proper release. It's called Prisoners of the Sun, and this is directed by Roger Christian, who directed The Sender, starring John Rhys-Davies and
Mr. Paycheck,
David Charvet, and co-written by Anthony Hickox. And also Anthony Hickox, I just wanted to mention him as well because
Waxwork,
he's a pretty cool mummy in Waxwork. Yeah. From 1988. And finally, there's a comedy from 1997 called Under Wraps with
that one's
kind of silly looking mummy.
Yeah, I've seen that movie. It's really goofy. It's more like a Family Channel type flick, but for some reason
it's a TV movie, and it's
isn't Seth
from
Green
the guy
in
who wrote License to Drive?
Is Seth
or directed
in that
License
one?
To Drive? I don't think so.
I just know that that's one of those movies that came out on like one of those really small labels like Madacy or something like that, where the DVD, Platinum Disc, I think it was, actually put it out, and the DVD is out of print and goes for a lot of money.
Yeah, it does.
And I'm not sure why, because it's a harmless, pretty forgettable mummy movie. I've seen it and I remember nothing about it.
Yeah. If you're interested in a mummy werewolf, there's a Face of the Screaming Werewolf starring Lon Chaney Jr. Finally, there's I've been kind of curious about this movie called Time Walker. Yeah. And I believe that has a mummy in it as well. That's I don't really know. I'm going to hopefully pick up the disc from Scream Factory.
It walks through time.
Yeah. Learn a bit more about it. But overall, yeah, I mean, I think that this genre, this subgenre in itself is just not... I mean, I think it's one that's really cool in theory, but yeah. I just don't think...
I don't think it's delivered as much as it should have.
Yeah, it's never really been executed that well. As Chris had expressed quite a bit of excitement over the Hammer pictures, I think those are the ones I'm probably going to want to revisit first, followed by the Universal ones. But I think a lot of this other stuff... I do want to see Tales from the Dark Side because I've never seen it.
Yeah.
But I just think even revisiting some of these, I don't think it's really been done right.
No, it's like I said, it's like, you know, it's not really like some of these other monsters subgenres like vampires and stuff have been totally cashed in on, whereas I feel like the potential of mummy movies has not been met at all.
I think had that first Karloff movie, the one with the Jack Pierce makeup, been done in a way that creature was through the whole movie, I think it would have been a complete, like a total classic, and it would have been the definitive movie. But unfortunately, you only get 5 minutes of that at the beginning. Yeah.
So as you can tell, Josh and I aren't exactly jazzed on mummy movies, and Tom Cruise isn't going to help matters on that front. But if you guys have any mummy movies that you actually are excited about that we missed that you think we would probably dig, and remember, we're not really the hugest fans of this subgenre, maybe drop us a line on our Facebook. Just search for GBW Podcast. And also, we're on Twitter at GBW Podcast. Also, we're on Instagram at GBW Podcast. And you can listen to this and past episodes on GBWpodcast.com. And of course, a rating, a review on iTunes. Awesome. We will love you forever.
Yes.
Yes. So with that, we're really fucking tired and we're really going to leave now.
Yes.
So I'm Chris. I almost said I was Josh.
Okay. I'm Josh and we're going to go to sleep. Good night.
All right. Good night, everyone.